Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Evening edition of The Horn. About a minute past the hour. And it is, this should prove to be a very, very special, very, very interesting Tuesday evening. We have a conversation scheduled in a few moments. And it is it's a conversation that took a lot of work to create, and most of that work was expended by our good friend Preston, who took it upon himself to do the booking for this. And you know what? I can't say enough about that effort, simply because the time needed to book a conversation like this is not insignificant. And so many thanks go out to Preston for this. In a few minutes, we're going to have a conversation with Sandra Steingraber. She is the best-selling author of a book called Living Downstream, now in its second edition. If Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was defining for her generation, so too is this book a defining statement for ours and for our time. I'm not sure if this book exists as a Kindle book on Amazon, and frankly, I don't know if it's an audiobook. Perhaps we'll find out from Dr. Steingraber. It comes from the Capo Press, a member of the Perseus Books Group, and it is readily available, Living Downstream, An Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer and the Environment. I think you will find this to be a fascinating conversation, and I think you will find the book well worth the effort of having on your shelf. Of course, it's the kind of book also that you read, you digest, and then sooner or later you're going to find somebody and say, holy crap, you got to read this book. No, I won't wait for you to buy it. Here, take my copy. Just bring it back. But they won't. And what they'll do is they'll take your copy, they'll read it, and pass it on to somebody else. It's that important. Dr. Steingraber literally establishes a threshold for what we have to do as a species in order to continue our inhabitation of the planet. I've been reading this book for over a week now. I'm pretty close to done with it, and it is not a. You would think that since it's got to do with environmental poisons and toxins and a particularly loathsome disease or cluster of diseases, you would think, wow, this is going to be a downer. It's not, because that is the magic of Dr. Steingraber. She is not merely a scientist, if there's such a thing as being merely a scientist. She is not just an ecologist. She is not just a biologist, although she holds a Ph.D. She also holds a master's degree in creative writing. And so this book reads much more like poetry than it does some sort of cataloging of grim fact. Let's take an example. Let's just go to the beginning of the book. The very beginning. I have a buddy of mine, and I have an old theory that says you can tell a lot about a book by its first paragraph. If the first paragraph doesn't grab you, the 432nd one's not going to do you any good either. Well, this has a first paragraph that'll grab you right out of the gate. Now, imagine this is a science book, okay? But it's also a very personal book. On a clear night after the harvest, central Illinois becomes a vast and splendid planetarium. This transformation amazed me as a child. In one of my earliest memories, I wake up in the back seat of the car on just such a night. When I look out the window, the black sky is so inseparable from the plowed black earth. Which dots are stars and which are farmhouse lights? That it seems I am floating in a great, dark, glittering bowl. And consider the epigraph to the book itself. A small fable. There was once a village along a river. The people who lived there were very kind. These residents, according to parable, began noticing increasing numbers of drowning people caught in the river's swift current. And so they went to work devising ever more elaborate technologies to resuscitate them. So preoccupied were these heroic villagers with rescue and treatment that they never thought to look upstream to see who was pushing the victims in. And then, very simply, this book is a walk up that river. We will be having about a 30-minute conversation, and I expect it to be as good a conversation, as important a conversation, as has been lately had on the Horn. It is that significant. It is that important. So with that in mind, we will take a moment, and we will I will get Dr. Steingraber on the line. And we will begin that conversation. So bear with me for a moment while I make the connection and prepare all as it needs to be. And we will come back. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is the Horn. Coming up, a conversation with Dr. Sandra Steingraber, author of Living Downstream. 13 minutes past the hour. This is The Horn, America's liberal voice. I am, of course, Bob. And as promised at the beginning of the program, on the line with me in a matter of moments, biologist, ecologist, author, poet, and concerned human, if I dare say such a thing, Sandra Steingraber will be joining us, author of Living Downstream, now a documentary, and in the book, it's in its second edition from DeCapo Press. Own this book, and once you have heard the conversation, you will know why I say such a thing. Dr. Steingraber is respected and praised roundly in all quarters, not only for her expertise as a scientist, but for the voice that she brings to the way in which she conveys the science, the book Living Downstream in its second edition. Dr. Steingraber, thank you very much for your time and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
It is a real joy and an honor and a privilege for me. As a West Virginian, one of my colleagues in the fight against mountaintop removal, coal extraction here, began saying several years ago, we are all downstream. And so when I saw the title of your book and saw the reference to the documentary film, little fireworks began going off, and I had to know more. Let's begin a little bit, if we may, just with some background information on what led you to the place of creating this book.
Well, I guess it goes back to my mom. She was a biologist in the 1940s at a time when that was an unusual career choice for women. And so I had a microscope by the time I was 9. And my first memory of my mom was cracking fossils open on our front step. She taught Darwin into Sunday school class. And she was diagnosed with breast cancer in her mid-40s, and by the time I was a senior in high school, had metastatic disease. So I went off to college to carry her banner on. I may otherwise have pursued a career in creative writing or drama. I was very active in school plays when I was in high school, but I decided to do biology. And then a couple of years later, I myself was diagnosed with cancer at the age of 20. I had bladder cancer. And so rather than go on to medical school, I spent some time in the medical library learning about the cause of my disease, found out it was considered a quintessential environmental cancer, and so began to be interested in not so much treating cancer, but understanding its causes and preventing it. And I guess I should say here that I'm adopted. And so even though my aunt went on to die of the same kind of bladder cancer I had, and even though my mom and I were in cancer treatment at the same time together, I also understood as a young biologist that we really needed to question that assumption that what runs in families necessarily runs in genes, because families share a lot of other things in common, like air, food, and water.
Certainly, I'm one of those people who, for instance, has a genetic predisposition to storing cholesterol and triglycerides, so I understand the genetic connection, but it would seem that your adopted status that took you out of that loop, Dr. Steingraber, and as a consequence, you had to examine the environmental effect or the environmental nexus between yourself, your cancer, and your future. When you began examining that, and as you mentioned, air, water, fire, time, the way that you the way that you divide your book, you found a tableau that was far more complicated than anything that you had been led to understand theretofore. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is. And I guess I should say to kind of finish the timeline here that I went on to get my PhD in biology. I also got a master's degree in poetry along the way. I didn't want to give up on my early love of creative writing. And so when I left the lab bench to work on writing about the evidence for the public, I tried to use everything I knew as a biologist to summarize the evidence for a link between cancer and biology. But I tried to write about it in a plain-spoken and lovely way to bring the loveliness of biology into my writing by creating a language as beautiful as the systems I'm writing about. And so thus there's a lot of lyricism as well. So really Living Downstream is two books in one. It's a biological argument and a description of how the environment interacts with the cellular machinery of our bodies. But it's also a love story between me and my hometown. And for that part of the book, I moved into my sister's basement for some time and became a kind of environmental detective. And I went in what I call a search for my ecological roots.
And what in that search for ecological roots, what were you, A, expecting to find versus, what, B, what did you find?
Well, I'm not sure what I expected, actually. I went in with an open mind and no other hypotheses than what I had gathered in the medical library, which is that there are, you know, classes of chemicals that are linked to bladder cancer, so I guess I went in search of those. What I found was that there are many hazardous waste sites in my hometown. I discovered that my landfill in where I grew up actually creates money for the county because it imports hazardous waste from as far away as New Jersey. I discovered that there are chemicals in the hometown drinking water wells, namely perchloroethylene, a chlorinated solvent that we use. It's used to dry clean clothes. In my hometown, it was probably ended up in the drinking water because it's also used to degrease metal parts in machine shops, of which we have many. And those show up periodically in the drinking water as well as other chlorinated compounds. And so although I'm a sample size of one, and as a biologist I can't say that my particular bladder cancer was caused by the bladder carcinogens in my hometown drinking water well, I also discovered that I'm just one data point in a larger collective story about human cancer. There is a unexpectedly high rates of cancer in the zip code where I grew up. And so what I do argue is that when chemicals known to cause cancer or suspected of causing cancer are released into our air, food, and water, somewhere someone is going to be confined to death. And that is a human rights problem that deserves our immediate attention.
And while you did create a sort of matrix with regard to your hometown, and I understand and respect what you say about being a data point of one and a sample size of one, there was nothing particularly unique nor overarchingly toxic about your hometown. It's a fair exemplar of so much of small town America. Would you say that? I mean, is that fair?
Yes, I would say that my hometown is a kind of everywhere USA. You know, it's just downstream from Peoria, Illinois. When you look out the back door of the house that my dad built, you can, when I was a kid anyway, you could look down and see the river, the Illinois River Valley, with all the barges being pushed by tugboats with full of their loads of corn and chemicals and coal. And out the front door, you could see corn and bean fields. And so it exists in a place where agriculture and industry are both practiced very intensely. And then that, I think there are many, many towns like this across our country. So I don't say that I grew up in an extreme place. I think I grew up in a typical place. I think for particular historical reasons, it became deeply chemicalized after World War II. And a lot of synthetic chemicals replaced more natural chemicals and contaminated the community. And that, I think, is a story that's replicated over and over. So I hope Living Downstream, both the book and the film, serves as a, not just my own autobiography, but a kind of roadmap for other people who also might wish to become environmental detectives in their own communities.
And is that the tipping point, if that phrase is appropriate? The Second World War and the post World War II boom in America and the transition to these largely petrochemicals, is that where this becomes a problem, or was it something that was extant in the United States but merely un or underreported prior to that time period?
Well, I think World War II was certainly a catalyst for it. Especially, this is the way I see it, is that our environmental crisis is kind of like a tree with two trunks. And one of those trunks is global climate change, and that is caused by the extraction of fossil fuels in the form of gas, which is really just a vaporous fraction of petroleum, right? So gas, petroleum, and coal. We take these out of the ground and we burn them, and we load up the atmosphere with carbon dioxide in such a way that we're threatening now to sink the whole life support system on which we all depend. The other trunk of the tree is what happens when we take some of those same petrochemicals and we use them as feedstocks for the chemical industry. And so rather than using manure as a fertilizer, we take natural gas and we turn it into anhydrous ammonia. And rather than using silk, we create chemicals like vinyl out of, again, natural gas in that case. And so when we make pesticides and plastics and all these synthetic chemicals out of petrochemicals, we load up our own bodies with chemicals that are don't break down very easily. They're unique to us. We don't have enzymes to break them apart. But they're not inert either. They're biologically active. And so they sometimes mimic our hormones. They sometimes turn on and turn off genetic switches. And so really our economic dependency on fossil fuels is behind both ecological crises, the one that's happening outside of our own bodies to the planet, but also the one that's happening inside our own bodies. And World War II accelerated that problem because, you know, there were German U-boats off the coast, so we needed a substitute for Japanese silk. We didn't have any more Chilean saltpeter, so we had to invent fertilizer from natural gas and so forth. And so a lot of synthetic chemicals were invented during that time to fill in for natural ones. And at the same time, we were inventing weapons of war. DDT was used to halt a typhus epidemic in Italy and then halted a malaria epidemic among our troops in the Pacific Theater. We invented 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, a popular herbicide. 2,4-D is still around. That was used to and first invented with the intent of destroying the Japanese rice crop. And then we ended up using it as a weapon of war in Vietnam because of course, we dropped the atom bomb on Japan before we had a chance to drop the chemical bomb. And so all these new chemicals then had a hero's welcome after the war was over and were deployed in backyards and really in the fabric of our lives. And so, yeah, the last 60 years or so since the war has been a time where people, you know, baby boomers and everybody after that, is actually born with these chemicals in their body by the time they're 0 years old.
Well, one of the things, Dr. Steingraber, that I have become aware of in the course of my career behind this microphone, I try to be as informed as I possibly can, and I've seen reference in news reports to studies, for instance, which say that there is not a mother in the United States capable of lactation who will not feed her baby mother's milk that is laced with the chemical components of rocket fuel, and the idea that that has become that pervasive, that it's not just, you know, a mother in New Jersey or a mother in California, but it's women all over this country, or the fact that you can take a hair sample from any woman of childbearing age in this country, and that mercury from coal-fired power plants will have given her enough mercury in her system over time to account for a 10-point IQ loss in any child that she bears. These things, Dr. Steingraber, and maybe it's because of a character flaw on my part, make me very angry. And I start wanting to look for somebody to punch, hang, shoot, and I know that makes me a bad person. But that's, and it's a very visceral response, but I recognize that that's not a solution to the problem. What is the solution beyond the basic caveman anger that this stuff engenders in me?
I don't think that having a fighting spirit is all wrong here. I mean, I have often said that I, as a cancer survivor myself, I learned to have hope in times of great desperation, and it's my great wish that people would bring the fighting spirit that they bring to their own cancer diagnosis to cancer prevention. Because after all, when you hear you have cancer, no matter how tough a hand that you're dealt and how poor your prognosis, nobody just, you know, throws up their hands and says, oh, well, we all have to die sometime. You know, people fight. And I think our planet is worth fighting for. You know, what we love, we have to protect. So I don't think anger is all bad. As an author, I tend not to fill up all my airwaves with anger because my as a writing strategy, I think that actually works to shut my readers down. So my hope is to kind of lay out the evidence and speak quietly, maybe, and hope that my readers will step up and fill in that emotional space with their own emotions rather than with all the ones that I might express. I think we're in a hopeful situation. I really do, in that, you know, if the evidence had shown us that, in fact, inherited predispositions was what was driving cancer rates, then there would be nothing we could do. You know, we can't change our ancestors. But happily, that's not what the data show. They show that most of us were born with a perfectly good set of genes to which something bad happened along the way. And in some cases, that's because we smoke, drink, or hold stressful jobs, or eat poorly. But there's also now compelling evidence that involuntary exposures to chemicals that other people are putting into the environment are also playing a significant role in the story of cancer. And at that point, we have a human rights story. You know, we have a problem just like we did in an earlier point in our nation's history when our economy was dependent on slave labor. It was just wrong. And our economy is now dependent on chemicals that are inherently toxic and in some cases cause cancer. That's also wrong. And so what we need to do is look around us for alternatives. And happily, green chemistry and green engineering, organic agriculture, have some really ingenious solutions for us if we only look around us.
Is there, as I went through the book and you so carefully and, yes, lyrically documented these various and sundry facets of our poisoning, for want of a better or shorter phrase, I began to ask myself the question, is there a delineation between acceptable risks versus unacceptable risks? Are there some chemicals that are causing these problems, these cancer clusters, that we simply can't get along without and we're just going to have to learn to live with, versus some that are clearly, I don't know, frivolous?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have yet to run across a carcinogen where I was really stumped, and I had to say, huh, you know, I just don't see how we're going to get along without this one. In my experience, you know, somebody somewhere has solved the problem. For example, perchloroethylene, the chemical I grew up drinking, dry cleaning fluid, we now have wet cleaning. You know, clever engineers have figured out how to redesign washing machines so we don't have to clean wool and silk and other garments that you wouldn't dare throw in your own Maytag at home. We don't have to clean them with a toxic solvent. You know, they can be wet cleaned or, well, there's just a lot of different techniques that don't rely on toxic chemicals that can clean textiles. Organic agriculture is growing by leaps and bounds, and it's, you know, not the same as my great-grandfather, who was also in organic agriculture at the beginning of the 20th century. Yields are high, profits are high. It's just that the farmers have used biological controls rather than chemical ones to keep the pests in check. So there are a lot of really ingenious solutions, and I look across the Atlantic sometimes for inspiration. The European Union has adopted a precautionary approach to toxic chemicals. Over there, the new law says that if it's not safe, you can't market it, and you have to demonstrate safety. We don't have any such law here, and it's really spurred innovation over there. So they've taken lots of toxic chemicals out of cosmetics and nail polish and car batteries and electronics and so forth. And so I think there are just so many solutions that already exist that need to be mainstreamed, and probably others that are waiting in the wings. I guess the big unsolved problem right now that really requires engineers to all get together and have some kind of Manhattan Project sense of urgency is to figure out how we can store energy from solar and wind power. That is the problem that we haven't solved yet, and that would get us a long way down the road if we could, but surely it's solvable with some R&D.
Yeah, well, a little human ingenuity, the same stuff that has stood us in such good stead since the first proto-hominid struck one rock with another rock and said, oh, fire. It is possible, and I do agree. It is not, however, and I don't think there's anything Pollyanna about your optimism, Dr. Steingraber, but because we do recognize the obstacles in our path. As I mentioned earlier, as a hillbilly, I'm deeply and intimately familiar with the horrors that come with coal extraction. It was December 2008 when the Kingston coal ash disaster took place in eastern Tennessee, sending some 4 billion gallons of concentrated toxic waste into the Clinch and Nolan Rivers and on down into the Tennessee River watershed. And this stuff was laced with arsenic and cadmium and barium and selenium and mercury and all manner of things that just aren't good for you.
It is amazing to realize that, you know, here we are with, you know, the leaders of the computer industries getting all this attention now for the latest rollout of phones that can do video conferencing and things like that, and yet we're still blowing up mountains to dig coal out and throw it in an oven to light on fire to turn the lights on. You know, it seems as though there's so many disconnects between the futuristic things in our economy and the things that are just sort of left over from the 19th century that are catching up with us. The interesting thing happening in West Virginia that I do mention in Living Downstream is that economic analysis that's gaining some traction. You know, I take a human rights approach to cancer, but there's an interesting economic analysis that's very compelling too. And this West Virginia has done a study showing that the amount of morbidity and mortality and lost human productivity caused by health problems related to the coal industry, including cancer, actually is higher than the profits and the tax revenues generated. So actually, coal mining is costing the state of Virginia rather than contributing to its coffers. And similarly in California, there was an economic analysis showing that exposure to toxic chemicals in children and workers, just those two sectors alone, were costing the state of California more than it was gaining from the revenue from these industries. And so it really doesn't make sense to keep doing the same old toxic thing, whether you look at it as lives lost needlessly and all the suffering, or whether you look at it just kind of bloodless economic way. Very compelling.
One of the things, Dr. Steingraber, that did impress me about the book is your human rights approach. Because that's the same approach that I take with mountaintop removal here in West Virginia. And the Dr. Hendricks study, Michael Hendricks out of WVU that you referenced there, he made it very clear. It costs us $5 to make a dollar from coal. And there's no economic argument in favor of that. And yet, in mentioning the coal ash disaster in eastern Tennessee, and in by way of mentioning obstacles, I was horrified a little bit after learning the basic facts about that coal ash disaster to find out that, lo and behold, our attempt to regulate coal ash in this country was being stymied. Who could have imagined that there was a lobby group, that in fact there is an American Coal Ash Association? You know, it's not exactly the Elks Lodge.
Yeah, well, of course, here in upstate New York, we're fighting against shale gas drilling, which is held up as the alternative to mountaintop removal, and what I'm arguing is that actually we're proposing to do with our bedrock what Kentucky has done to its mountains, which is to shatter them and to blow them up with explosives, extract the fossil fuels, and leave a mess behind, including contaminated water. And so I think shale gas is no alternative to mountaintop removal. It's just more of the same. It's like an alcoholic switching from whiskey to wine or something, you know, rather than admitting that we have a substance abuse problem here and it's time to do something about it.
Well, and indeed, you're right. The Marcellus Shale extends on down into the Appalachians, and it's a concern basically for everyone east of the Mississippi because of what it does to water. When you talk about hoping that your writing creates a sense of activism and a willingness to be to enter the fray, if you will, on the part of your readers. How do people who have been activated by your book how do they begin to manifest that, and how do they do it because obviously our side does the one thing that cripples us in the economic model that we use in the United States, Dr. Steingraber, is the fact that we don't have the money the other side has. And they can have an American Coal Ash Association to lobby the EPA. How do we, it's not so much how do we counter their ideas. Our ideas are based upon science, where theirs are based upon, I don't know, greed, avarice. But the money is drowning the whole argument out.
Well, certainly we do face very formidable obstacles and inequality between, you know, lobbyists who are getting a salary to be there to do their work, and the rest of us who are taking time off from work to go to Washington. It's real. But I guess I still maintain that the biggest obstacle, bigger than that even, is people's sense of fatalism, and this is where I hope the writing and also the film Living Downstream can play a role, because a lot of people have given up before they've even started fighting. They look at this and they feel that it's too late. They feel that that nothing they could do, they can't imagine, that would make a difference. And so, therefore, not only do we have less money, but we're paralyzed by despair. And I think I agree with the sociologist Eileen Crist, who has said that fatalism is really a form of conformity disguised as realism. So the fatalist thinks they're being realistic, that nothing can possibly change, when actually they're just kind of conforming and going along with the same old toxic practices. When I was in Switzerland in Geneva, testifying at the United Nations conference, the most powerful testimony I heard came from Inuit women whose breast milk was so contaminated with toxic chemicals used by other people in the industrialized areas and carried to the Arctic by long-distance transport, that their children were suffering such terrible ear infections that they were going deaf because their immune system was so compromised. And so they were accusing the world of committing ecological genocide against the Inuit people. And it was such a powerful testimony that I felt hearts and minds in that room of all the delegates change. In fact, the treaty that they were negotiating, the Persistent Organic Pollutants Treaty, in fact, moved forward. And so I do think that that we still have a great power available to us, but we can't give up before we start fighting. I was in Washington recently to participate in a briefing before both houses of the staff on both sides of the House, House of Representatives and the Senate, and met with White House staff to talk about the results of the President Cancer Panel report, which concludes that indeed cancer, environment plays a bigger role in the story of human cancer than has been previously appreciated. And, you know, there were plenty of people in Washington whose job it was to deal with this, who were checking their BlackBerry and not paying attention and being interruptive, and yet there were others who were rapidly paying attention, and I think there were some, you know, hearts that were moved there.
That is, well, that's a brilliant testament. When we talk about, you mentioned earlier that that idea of fatalism as a form of conformity, I've got to go and find that, and I've got to go read that. That's brilliant. The other upshot from the moneyed interests who would like to continue pumping this stuff into our world, they have megaphones in the forms of media like Fox News and so forth. What kind of success or struggle even have you had reaching out to the denialists? Lord knows there's an entire industry now devoted to nothing more than denying the idea of global climate change. What has that meant for you?
I think different strategies work for different audiences, and so I'm always interested in reaching my readers with whatever they're particularly interested in. Earlier today I did a radio interview on a program that's devoted entirely to athletes, really extreme athletes, you know, whose life it is to pump up their muscles. And so what I'm interested in talking to athletes about is, you know, the evidence that shows that air pollution can actually punch holes in the alveoli of your lungs in ways that reduce your tidal volume, reduce the amount of air you can actually breathe in and out, and can affect your athletic performance. I mean, athletes are more ecological than other people because they breathe more air, drink more water, consume more calories on a day-to-day basis than non-athletes, and so the ecological world is flowing through them, and they might want to understand the kind of chemical contaminants in air, food, and water that are becoming part of their bodies and affecting their athletic performance. That's a very different conversation than conversations I have with nursing mothers, where I might speak to them mother to mother. You know, I became a cancer patient at 20, but a mom at 40, and I nursed my own two children for several years. And so the evidence showing us that chemicals in breast milk can actually interfere with a woman's ability to make milk, make sufficient milk for her child, is something that I might talk to nursing mothers about. So essentially what I say to my readers is, look, you know, we're all part of this great human orchestra, and it really is time now to play the Save the World Symphony. You don't have to play a solo, but you do have to know what instrument you play and hold it as well as you can. So if you're a middle school girl, maybe you want to fight for your right for non-toxic nail polish, you know? If you're a football player, you might want to be interested in clean air. If you are a cook, maybe you should source with local organic farmers and so forth. So, you know, I'll talk to my readers about whatever it is that they're interested in. And then, of course, now that the book has been turned into a film, it has a kind of immediacy for people who don't necessarily turn to books for any reason. You know, a lot of the people who I wrote the book for are not readers of books. They live in communities that are at the tailpipe end of toxic contamination, and having a film is going to be a better vehicle for them to understand something than books.
And it was in fact the trailer to the film that first reached out and just got hold of me.
There you go.
Exactly. How is that being distributed? How can people see it? What can they do to access it? Is it a purchase situation, or is it being played on channels? What's going on with the film?
Well, I mean, I'm an author, so I'm new to this whole business of making the film. I have to say I'm thrilled about it. I think it turned out really well, and I know a lot of authors don't say that about their film adaptations, but I'm so impressed with the filmmaker. We spent 4 years on it, and then, of course, that prompted me to write an updated second edition of Living Downstream to come out in tandem with the book. And so the film right now is being shown in theaters and at film festivals. By next fall, it will be available as a DVD, so people can pre-order that if they'd like at livingdownstream.com. So the film has its own website, livingdownstream.com, and of course the trailer now is available for people to watch. I have to say that one of the things that books do better than films is that books can take you back in time. Like, I can show you in my book the moment where I was diagnosed with cancer at age 20 in 1979. We couldn't reconstruct that in a documentary film. But what the film does instead is take you into one of my own cancer checkups now, and it also takes you into an autopsy of a whale that has died of cancer. So it's very visual, and of course it can do in a few seconds what it would take me pages and pages as an author to describe. So I'm really pleased with it, and I hope it's useful to folks.
I sincerely believe that it will be, Dr. Steingraber. Let me ask one last thing. I think I would be remiss if I did not. A lot of people in this country are anxiously awaiting the address by the president tonight regarding the situation in the Gulf. Based on what you know with about petrochemicals and their ilk, what kind of risk has been foisted upon the Gulf Coast as a result of what BP has done?
Well, this is the problem, of course, with ecological catastrophes. They're uncontrolled experiments that we've never done before, and the ecological world has so many variables and so many moving parts that it makes predictions really, really difficult. So my hope is not so much to hear what's going to be done to clean this up, because I think it's whatever is going to happen is going to be very tricky and going to be incomplete, as was this bill in Santa Barbara, as was this bill in Alaska. Instead, what I'm looking to hear is a statement of never again, that this is a lesson that's going to be learned, and this is the moment now that our children and grandchildren will look back and say, you know, that is what finally woke people up to realize that we can't just keep doing this till we get every single wisp of hydrocarbon out of the ground. You know, we've gotten all the easy oil and the easy gas and the easy coal out already. Now we have to blow up mountaintops. Now we have to do it in the middle of the ocean. Now we have to blow up the whole Marcellus shale and threaten our drinking water. And at that point, you know, that's the time now to have this incredible transformation from fossil fuel-based economy to renewables. And hopefully this is that moment.
Dr. Steingraber, this has been a conversation that has literally flown by for me, and I could spend hours. but you have generously given us a half an hour, and I really appreciate the time that you did share with us. I never like to end a conversation without making sure that I haven't missed something that you in particular wanted to make sure got said. Is there anything left?
I thought your questions were great. I would say that, you know, what we love, we must protect. And I feel that this is my life's work now to kind of build a bridge over what we in the scientific community know about the causes of cancer and their relationship to the environment and what the public knows, which is not yet a lot. And so I would just urge people to, you know, keep their ears and eyes open and be receptive to the data. I think people are afraid they're going to feel terrible if they learn about this, but actually you feel better. I think knowledge is power. And after all, learning about cancer in the environment gives us a meaningful place to begin a program of cancer prevention and actually save lives, and that's heroic. And we can be heroes here, just as the abolitionists used to be heroes.
Thank you, Dr. Steingraber, and best of luck. And I hope the film is a magnificent success and that the second edition of the book flies off shelves. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you very much.
Have a great evening.
You too.
Bye now. Dr. Sandra Steingraber, Living Downstream, out in its second edition, a companion to the new film, Living Downstream. There is a website, livingdownstream.com. I never know what to expect from these conversations, and this is this has been a treat, because this is not an easy topic to address, but she does address it so exquisitely, so amazingly, with such not only knowledge and intellect, but passion and compassion. If you've ever read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, you know the kind of book I'm talking about. This is Silent Spring for the 21st century. There are questions put forward in this book that only you and I can answer. They cannot be answered on by corporate America or by corporate transnationals, because they have a vested interest in continuing to poison us and our progeny, our future, our world. And so they are not going to, to do anything to make life better. It will only be by the principled stands that you and I make that we will go forward into a world that is fit to live in, not only for ourselves, but for those whom we have not yet even dreamt of. There are so many stories out there that are breathtaking in their scope that hinge on this. You know, last night we touched upon this announcement of vast new mineral wealth resources found just under the ground in Afghanistan. And like I said, I read that headline and I just put my little head in my hands and I thought, oh, the poor Afghans are screwed. Because they have a corrupt government run by a guy by the name of Hamid Karzai. You know Hamid Karzai, right? Yeah, before he was installed as the puppet head of our puppet government in Afghanistan, lo and behold, Hamid Karzai was what? Yeah, he was a fixer. He was a fixer for UNICAL. And, of course, that pipeline that they want to get from, you know, the Caspian Sea Basin to the Pakistani shoreline and has to run through Afghanistan, that was a UNICAL project. Just saying. So anything that involves lining Hamid Karzai's pockets or those of his extended clan, guess what? It's going to happen. And no good will come to the people of Afghanistan out of the extraction of their resource riches. Because, you see, resource extraction in any developing world, whether it be, or developing country, whether it be Afghanistan or Nigeria or Appalachia, because just because we're in the United States doesn't mean that we're not treated like a resource colony, because if you've listened to this program at all for any length of time, you know by God we are. If you look at what happens to any native people who happen to find that they have mineral wealth under their feet, there is no good outcome for any of them. And yes, that extends to the Inuit people whose mothers cannot breastfeed their children. Sweet Jesus, can you imagine how much you can't get any further out from the developed world than the frozen north of what were formerly referred to as Eskimos. And an Inuit woman can't safely nurse her baby? You see, the thing that scares me and the thing that cautions me is that I know that for every person of goodwill that Dr. Steingraber, that she activates, there's a boner in Congress, and there's a Rush on the radio, and there's a Bachman on the floor of the House talking about CO2 being good for you. It's natural. Sister, so is arsenic. So is cadmium, selenium, barium, magnesium, manganese, aluminum, arsenic. It's all quite natural. The trick, I think, is learning that natural doesn't necessarily mean good, and understanding the enemy that we face going in. I have a story here. I have a story that I think goes hand in hand with this. It is a CNN story. There has been a mystery afoot in Nigeria. And of course, anyone who knows anything about global transnational exploitation of resource wealth in the developing world, what a mouthful, knows that Nigeria, which once was an exquisite and wild place, is now one of the hells that have yawned open on the planet. This story from CNN datelined Yangalama, northern Nigeria. They had had a string of inexplicable, seemingly inexplicable child deaths. I don't know if you saw this story. I've hung on to it because it turned my stomach. Standing in the graveyard, Rabiu Muhammad prays silently in a cemetery that has filled quickly with small, telltale mounds of earth. It's hard to imagine as many freshly dug little graves side by side in a place that's not a war zone as there are right now in the Nigerian village of Yangalama. Rabiu Muhammad lost 2 children. At least 68 other boys and girls are buried alongside them, one-third of the village's children. They started dropping dead in January, 6 months ago. For months, the cause was a mystery. Finally, village authorities, local authorities, called in international medical agencies. Rabiu Muhammad explained, "These are months of fear and trepidation for this village. You've either lost a child, or your brother, or a friend, or someone close to you has lost a child." The U.S. Centers for Disease Control estimate that 163 people died across the region, 111 of them children. Although the article doesn't say it, suffice to say that this is not a place of wealth. This is not a place where the privileged live. Not by any stretch of the imagination. It is a place for the poor and the struggling, the tribal, the clannish, the subsistence living people. And it is not surprising to find out that the children in question, the dead children in question, well, it turns out they died of lead poisoning. No, they weren't eating paint chips in their old and run-down ramshackle houses, as is prone to happen in places like Appalachia. No. No, they died of lead poisoning that they literally brought into their own lives. You see, Nigeria has gold under its ground. And the developed industrial world has a sickness of the heart that can only be cured by gold. Desperate for something on which to live, these villagers brought gold ore home. In their homes, the ore was smashed, crushed by hand, and it was processed in the village of Yangalama, northern Nigeria. A byproduct of this process was the lead bound up in the ore, as well as other waste heavy metals. It is illegal, by the way, in northern Nigeria to do unofficial mining. But there is so little for people there to make a living on that they do it anyway. And in this case, the miners of Yangalama found a seam of gold ore that was particularly heavy laden with toxins. And so it was that their children went to sleep at night, laying their heads in the dust of the pulverized ore, sleeping on burlap bags used to transport the ore back to the village and absorbing it, the toxins, into their bodies all the while. 50 children are still being treated with what I would assume to be chelation therapy, a medication that will bind itself to lead in their bloodstream so that the lead can be released through their urine. 50 more children are expected in the next few weeks. The expected level of lead in the bloodstream is some measurement whose number is under 10. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, a spokesman for MSF, said with some of the initial samples that were taken and sent off for testing in Europe, we found levels over 300. And because there is no attempt to provide a meaningful subsistence for the people of Yangalama and surrounding villages, the mining continues apace. But it is a particularly grim, grim struggle because the rainy season is coming. And when the rainy season comes, the filth from the mining will run all over. And it will run in the waters. And as Dr. Steingraber titled her book, it will run downstream. and we are all downstream. Just as they are in Yangalama, Nigeria, where the graves are small and many. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. I'm Bob, and this is The Horn.
Means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Almost 8 minutes past the hour as we enter the second hour of this Tuesday night edition of The Horn. I get so blown away by conversations like this that I find myself a little bit scatter-minded for the remainder of the program, so you'll have to bear with me because these things reverberate inside me long after the conversation has stopped. A reminder from News Ninja Susan, if you go to the show post on the main website, headonradionetwork.com, if you click, there's a rotator there at the top. If you click on the image of Dr. Steingraber's book, you can purchase it through the Horn, and that does us a little bit of good, which is nice. This is one to own. It really, really is. Had I not received a promotional copy, I would have gladly purchased it for myself. Because it so elegantly defines the terms of the debate, the discussion, and all of that which is at risk. You know the phone number for getting involved with the program, I trust. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, it's 304-658-3333. Do you guys think it's worthwhile to run President Obama's address live during the show this evening, or would you just rather talk through it and talk over it? I will leave that up to you. That thing comes your way, our way, at about 8 p.m. Let's go to the phones and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program.
My vote is to keep the program going. It'll be enough YouTube and other stuff to see Obama speak later.
Good one. I'll chalk that up for let's keep it rolling. That's my inclination, too.
Yeah. Just a speech, it ain't going to really do anything change too much right at the moment. I mean, maybe down the line, but not right now.
Yeah.
So anyway, but anyway, first off, man, great interview. That was, I think that was one of your better ones, but probably your best one.
Well, it felt terribly, terribly close to home.
Oh, yeah. It was, she was on point. Wow. You know, just well said, well thoughtful, just the right temperament, you know. Just, right on the money.
Yeah, because like I said, I'm not kidding. It is an elegantly written book, but I read it and you know, I really wanted to go find me an executive to shoot. Sorry, I'm a bad person for thinking that way, and it runs contrary to my sense of nonviolence. But you know, damn, they're not being nonviolent with us.
Maybe you can go hire Sandra. I think she'll do it. She'd be a great hit woman, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, like I said, I think the whole thing's interesting. I think that one of the problems is that, I think one thing, you know, it's not coming out enough is, you know, we talked about this before, is that it seems like we're just sitting here waiting for Obama or somebody just to do something. And we don't want to acknowledge our own complicity in this whole thing ourselves. And you know where I'm going with that. You know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, we can tell BP to go to hell and then BP will just come back with us. Well, then they say, well, don't buy a product. Or the oil industry, don't buy a product.
Try living without it. And, you know, that's one of the things. There's a lot of boycott BP stuff out there. And the problem is, if you see a station that has that big, stupid, green, stylized sunflower on it, and it says BP, and you go, oh, I'm not going there. Well, what you've done is you've harmed the guy who paid the franchise price to run his little Rippy Mart and sell gasoline. But if you stop at a station that doesn't say BP, there's no guarantee you're not pumping BP gas into your car.
Yeah. Well,
because they've got...
Edit, go throw out your Tupperware. You know, I mean, petroleum's in everything. So,
right.
I mean,
that's not to say that economic action isn't valid, But when we take economic action, we have to make sure that we're taking economic action that counts. And they've got the oil companies in particular have sort of refined this whole dodge, this whole scheme, to a system that is immune to economic action. It's not immune to crazy people in the Middle East. Yeah, or rigs that blow up and poison our and poison our coastlines, but it is immune to anything that we want to do about it, or so they think. You know, the one thing that I think we have going for us is that we can start raising a ruckus, a bigger ruckus, wanting to get away from these fossil fuels, and that is the one thing they cannot do anything about, unless they poison us all.
Yeah, well, I think they're hell bent on poisoning us all because, see, at least with, the two important, the two major forces in the world is love and hate. And I think the third one now is greed. Is that greed is blind. At least with love and hate, it's got a vision. They know what they want to do, but greed just can go in any direction. I think being blind in that way about greed. I mean, these people are so greedy. You've seen all the reports of the emails and everything. I mean, it's clear that the whole thing was about greed, ego, the whole vanity of it all. It really wasn't about just just the construct of bringing something decent to market. It was just pure unadulterated greed that the people just broke violation after violation. And I think greed is right now, beyond even love and hate, seems to be the most deadly thing on this planet, man. It just seems like everything now is just greed and hate. I mean, you got the banking industry greed. You look at, the healthcare greed. Now you got this, obviously for years we've had, this energy policy that based on greed. I mean, at some point somebody just needs to identify. And it's really what I've been waiting for Obama to do. Truman used to do it. I mean, Roosevelt years ago used to do it. And he pointed out that greed is the enemy. It's abstract, but it's still something that's tangible. So it's not like he can't point it out and people not, see it. You know what I mean? And somehow he has to define that in a way because this thing is so, it's almost like a virus. It's so large that it spreads to where it's hard to pinpoint it, but yet we all know it's there. So somehow he just needs to define it. And I have yet to see him do it on a consistent basis.
And I guess he has to be a cheerleader for the Florida Gulf Coast beaches. But and maybe this is a function of a character flaw on my part. But dadgummit, when I heard him say the beaches here are wonderful, come down to the beaches of Florida, do it now. When I heard him say that today, the only thing I could hear inside my head was George W. Bush saying, "Go shopping, go to Disney World."
Go shopping.
It's the same thing, isn't it?
That dumbass laugh.
Yeah, it's the
same. If Obama doesn't do that, if he starts doing that, then we're really in trouble.
It's a different laugh, I think, but it's the same thing, isn't it? Don't worry about the disaster coming. Go and spend money, engage yourself in the consumer culture, run your credit card debt up some more, and be a good American.
Well, I think the problem right now with the presidency, and I think this goes over a number of presidencies, it goes back to Reagan, Jimmy Carter, well, maybe not Jimmy Carter, maybe stop there, but is that the office really still has become a mirror of the American people because there's so many forces. Like, I would love Obama to do some of the more progressive things because I obviously think that's the right thing to do. But as seeing, a person had, been around with the DNC and seeing Howard Dean when he came in and how he became, a person who had to try to work from a governing point of position, it's one thing to talk a lot of crap when you're outside of things, but when you have to actually get something done and bring people on board and you have to give them something, the other side something to get them to work with you, the presidency becomes just a mirror of what we all kind of want as a group and not just one group, even if that one group is right. And I just think even tonight, I think all we're really going to get is something that Obama feels it'll push toward what we want, but it's probably not going to be fast enough to keep up with the destruction that may be possibly, coming. You know what I'm saying? It's not. It may not be fast. You may not hit the pedal fast enough. That's what I'm more concerned about. I'm not concerned about the direction he's trying to go. I think the situation is pushing us in the right direction. Just the question is, how far is he going to put that pedal to the floor tonight? And you know, I don't know yet.
Yeah, but does anybody really expect him to say, well, you know, we're really going to whip the oil companies and don't you bastards dare go bankrupt, or you know, I'll hunt you down with a rope. Does anybody expect that out of him?
Well, if he do, then the BP stock will drop, and then BP will say, well, we don't have the money to pay out. So, you know what I'm saying? So it's almost like, again, it's almost like it's collective complicity. You know, it's like, you know, I know that a lot of people talk about the pensions in Britain, but from what I understand, 40% of BP is owned by America.
That's right.
Well.
And again, that's sort of like the business with economic action, because they've got the thing set up to minimize any potential harm. No, it's not owned by it's a transnational corporation. It's owned by all kinds of people.
Should he come out and just do a 9/11 and say, look, these mugs about the cave in the ocean floor. And, you know, we can't, you know, I mean, should he go that far to bring some apocalyptic vision to people, get the freaking message that this is no game, we can't be, you know what I'm saying? I mean, what do we need as evidence to push it forward? I think in the interview, what the good doctor said was so right on, is that she says, okay, we've pushed the boundaries of how far that we could get the oil in terms of the shallow waters and shallow things. We can't go any further. You know, in other words, you know, you're setting up a line now, you know, but these mugs are not going to stop because they're so greedy. They're going to go over the line. You know that. And somebody has to rein them in.
Right, because it's profit-driven.
Yeah. I mean, you're blowing up mountains. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, tonight, you know, look, there are going to be people all around this country lighting up to watch the NBA game on big screen TV. So we need the electricity. So blow up a mountain. At some point, somebody's got to say, wait a minute. You know, how about conserving things? You know, why do we have to have all our sports events at night? You know, you know, I don't know.
You know what? I'm of a certain age, and I remember a time when the World Series had day games.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember day games, you know, featuring the Pirates and the Orioles, for instance. Are you an Orioles fan?
No.
Okay. Well, it's kind of your neck of the woods,
Yankees,
so I wouldn't.
Yankees.
Oh, not another one. Come on. Okay.
Well, I grew up in Florida, and, you know, my father used to take me to spring training for a lot of
games. Okay, sure. So, yeah, you developed the connection. At least you developed it naturally.
And I lived in New York in the summer, you know, in Quad City, so I used to go to Yankee Stadium when I was a kid, so.
Okay.
Roll team from 75.
Yeah. And by the way, voting is running vastly in favor of keeping the show rolling and not going to the speech. I think you conjured Sandra because she just wrote in and said, let's not listen to Obama's speech and just say we did. Because
yeah.
We can all pretty much predict what's going to be in it. I think that's the subtext of what Sandra said there, don't you? We all know he gives great speech.
There's nothing he can say right now that's going to stop that oil gush from Russia. And that's really the issue. You know, I was listening to Carl, I think it was Dave from Maine last week, and I understood his frustration, but he was going on about Obama should go down to do a town hall and all these other things. And that, you know, it sounds good and everything, but that's not going to do the issue right now. They got to figure out how to stop that.
Unless he has skills that I don't know he has, like, you know, those business suits are hiding his Aquaman fins. And he can get under the water and call out to his friends, the dolphins, to come and fix the blowout preventer. There's not a lot to be.
This is a collective F up, and we have to all realize we're all complicit in it.
Well, what was that line earlier today when he was speaking in Pensacola? What was that line about, we are going to mobilize the massive strength of the military to fight this problem? What, is he gonna go shoot the well?
Well, I've been an advocate of, you know, I'm kind of a little bit of a gambler myself. I've been an advocate of, you know, and I don't understand all the technology. I'm looking at it from a 3D modeling standpoint. I've been somewhat of an advocate of nuking the well down at a certain beat, you know, because I'm more hearing about this whole thing that the whole well is now compromised and it's actually leaking from the seabed floor, you know. And that
the seafloor is compromised, but that's the problem. What does setting off a nuke do to the seafloor?
Well, it depends on that's the thing. Here's the thing: you got two visions. You got a slow death, or you roll the dice. So I mean, if that thing is coming out, if that thing is compromised down at the whole well, and it never stops leaking, and if it goes on and goes on and goes on, it's going to destroy the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, don't you think that's what's going to happen?
Yeah.
So is that worth taking the risk of possibly?
Well, the thing I keep coming back to, Gary, is that there are ways of using explosives that don't involve nuclear devices. Like the thermite thing that would melt the steel around the wellhead. I don't know if it would work or not. But what I do know is the irony that, you know how I am about religion, right?
I don't, Bob, why don't you tell me?
No, let's don't and say I didn't. But you know what? These people are fast pushing me toward being a deist of some sort. Because when lightning strikes, on the same day, mind you, on the same day, when lightning strikes a giant Jesus statue in Ohio,
okay,
and strikes the ship that's trying to pump out the oil and save it for later commercial sale, I'm almost ready to buy into some religious structure. Because, you know, that's not Pat Robertson predicting that the homos are going to cause an earthquake.
Revelation 16, the oil field, you know.
Yeah, this looks like a friendly tap on the shoulder. I sent the lightning bolt to knock down the idolatrous Jesus statue at the same time I sent the lightning bolt over here on the ship that wants to go and sell the oil that's being pumped out. Anybody getting a clue? Clue? Anybody? Could this be a clue? So, that was just weird. You know, the Jesus statue and the ship getting struck in the same day.
I usually hear about those type of things. I actually passed that one by. I'm surprised, you know, I do listen to Coast to Coast sometimes. I know you don't.
Well, and I was about to say, I am not turning this into Art Bell and George Norrie. I don't want any phone calls about aliens.
Only the good interviews, not the UFO stuff.
Right. No, I don't want any phone calls about aliens or UFOs.
Only time I don't listen to them is if Alex Jones come on, you know, those type of guys. But if you have on a Nobel Prize winning scientist, I mean, you know, they do have some good interviews. I listen to them. So most of the time I'm surprised I didn't hear about the Jesus that you can start, but I'm glad you brought it up because I will look into that because I'm looking for any kind of sign at this point because I think this thing is possibly apocalyptic. I kind of felt that way from the beginning, but I do personally believe that, in my opinion, nuclear probably bad because then you're doubling up because now you got an ocean with nuclear substances in it. I wasn't talking about a big one, but
and it would take forever to drill the hole for it too.
Yeah, somebody was saying that there's a way that they could slide it into the hole through the pressure, but I don't know how that would actually.
You know, I don't want to play with that, given the physics of what's going on with that incredibly pressurized, really really wet natural gas that's blowing out of there. No, I don't.
And I personally don't think the relief valve is going to work. At least the first one. The second one, I think may work, and I think it was smart of at least administration to do the second one because I don't trust BP to do anything. I did read a couple of engineering sites, and a lot of them were saying that, you know, your leaf well-driven is not perfect. And he said, and at that depth, you know.
No, it only works if you do it on the front end at the same time you're drilling the main well. Then it stands a chance of giving you some relief. But doing it after the fact, no, not so much. And you know, like I said, I don't want to make this all George Bell and Art Bell and George Norrie. But there are stuff out there that just makes my brains roll around like little marbles, like this business of, for instance, I noticed something the other day. Rand Paul and Tony Hayward apparently have the same hairdresser. What do you walk away with from that? Well, they've got the same life view, they've got the same world view, they've got the same anything for a buck approach to living on the planet. You know, is it in the shampoo? Only their hairdresser knows. So
yeah,
no,
but at least
weird stuff out there, Gary.
Racial statements from Tony Hayward, but I don't think he has a large respect for life as it is, you know, obviously, in the comments.
No, he has a tremendous respect for his life and his ability to follow West Ham football, go sailing and taking ski vacations in Vail. That's the life that he respects.
Well,
but what blows my mind is that he is married to a geophysicist. He's, you know, a geophysicist. Tony, dear, you might not want to drill that really big hole there.
So what do you find this? I'm not going to turn this into an argument. What do you think of the symbolism of America and the soccer thing, that we're now one-to-one with them? We're looking at them eye to eye now, that they're not dominating us. Do you see any symbolism in that?
No, because I know, you know, we'll probably get out of this round, maybe, if everything doesn't blow up in our face. But then, no, we're chowder in the elimination rounds.
Okay.
You know, we run up against the Germans are just they are a mowing machine. And the Argentines aren't terrible. And you know, we haven't seen Brazil and Spain yet, and everybody says, no, they play the game at a Gretzky level. I guess that's the best way to put it.
I watched the Brazilians play Korea today.
Okay, so I didn't get to see that.
Yeah, they were up to, when I saw them, they were up to nothing, and it was clear that, you know, I won't get into the Brazilian thing, but they, you know, Korea couldn't even get past, you know, the half mark. I mean, Brazil was putting pressure on their side the whole time. You know, so it was like...
Yeah, they were a machine.
Like, yeah, as soon as the guy, the main guy, I forgot his name, scored, they took him out of the game. He's like, I'm okay, I'm going to sit down. You know, and they put another person in. It's like, you guys, you know, well, it's North Korea, so we expect, I mean, Korea, but still, it's just like, okay, we're waiting for the, you know, real dogs.
But North Korea did manage to...
I'm hoping for England, for us, though. We got to hold some hope, Bob, you know, for USA.
Oh, I'd love to see us do it. I would love to, because it would just be cool. You know, I'd love to. Ghana played a great game. I'd love to see them go on. And I want to see Australia get well too. Although I don't know if they can.
I want to ask you one quick question. I'm gonna let you go. I know you probably got other callers. You know, as I was watching, you know, the games. You know, the one thing, you know, it's about, you know, the games and stuff. Obviously, soccer. I was down in Brazil actually recently. So, you know, I've kind of gotten an affinity for watching the game. And the thing is that, you know how the game goes. You know. For the World Cup, is, you know, in general, it's 45 minutes straight through, basically no timeouts or anything. Even if somebody gets injured or whatever, they just make up the time.
Right.
At a thing. So there's no chance of any commercials, you know. So it, even though it's low scoring, it still flows well. And do you ever think that a game like that with no commercials, interruptions, outside of obviously the mastheads on the, you know, on the side of the board, billboards and stuff like that, any chance for something like that to ever be an American sport?
I think that's why it doesn't get traction on American TV as it is.
Okay.
And that's a relationship not only based on the game and the advertiser, but on the watching end of it too. Because the one thing that the American sports fan, be it a baseball fan, hockey fan, the basketball, football, anything, the one thing we can count on is that somewhere along the way we get a commercial so we can go pee. And because there's beer involved 9 times out of 10. And
yeah, they don't score a lot, so it's not, you know what I'm saying? It's not like,
no, but see, that's the thing. It's when you, no, at least with a commercial in American football or baseball or basketball, you know that nothing is going to happen and you're not going to miss anything while you're gone to the John.
Yeah, true.
On the other hand, with soccer or the real football, you walk away, you know, I mean, because I'm one of those snake bit people in the universe. If I'm really into it and I'm sitting there watching and I just can't wait and I gotta go and I leave and I come back, and while I'm in there, I'm gonna hear, goal! I'm gonna A, spray down the bathroom, and B, hate myself. And I think that interferes with the saleability of soccer as a television vehicle in this country. But
okay,
then again, that also shows up exactly how shallow I am.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I've been watching the NBA Finals, and I can tell you, I don't pee that much, okay? Every freaking time you turn around and go into commercial, you don't pee that much.
Yeah, we'll be back with more Kobe right after this. Yeah, or we'll be back with more commercials right after Kobe scores another bucket.
Right,
no, that's
I'm going to keep you going.
All right, Gary, have a great evening. Good talking to you, my friend.
All right.
Bye now. Yeah, I'm shallow. But then again, that's news. You know, come on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, sir, it's Lee.
Hey, Lee, what's up?
You know, he stuns me every once in a while. Gary didn't call him very often, but, yeah, he knocks me out. He drops a revelation verse on you, and then immediately goes, so how's the U.S. going to do in the World Cup? So I don't know if he wants to go with, 16-1? I heard a loud voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath of God on the earth. But he should have jumped to probably verse 3. The second angel poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became blood as of a dead man. Every living thing in the sea died. That being said, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, you know, I'm great. And by the way, I got to tell you, I watched the Rosie Flores videos and saw you back there just keeping that time. It was great stuff. It was great stuff. And, you know, what a pro she is.
I'm a semi-pro. By the way, I did actually check the time frame on when you actually sent those emails, since you went into complete and total, Southern Hick lexicon on me.
Yeah.
I noticed it was about 1:45 a.m.
Oh, I work late.
You have a couple of pops or no? Because you went just, I was like, wow, at least I can read this because I've been drinking.
No, actually, no. Mere exhaustion is enough to bring that out in me.
It was funny. You use more apostrophes than anybody I know, sir.
Well, you know, that's because I like them a lot. You know, the late, great Kurt Vonnegut said, the only thing a semicolon proves is that you've been to college. So I opt for apostrophes so as not to seem pretentious.
No, I really appreciate the fact that you dug it. I really did. And she's fantastic. I was real lucky to be playing behind her. Something you said was something like, you need to play at my funeral, she boy, or something like that. By the way, today is the 41st, as far as birthdays go, 41 years ago today, Hee Haw first went on the air.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You remember that whole thing where you'd have the, where they'd pop up out of the corn or whatever it was? You got one that was like, you know, and I don't know how to do this, what? Let me think about this. Hold on. Roy Clark, semicolon. What do you call a guy that doesn't use birth control? You know, Grandpa Jones, semicolon. A daddy, you know?
Right.
Sorry. And about that time they go back in the corn and the banjo starts playing again and everything else. But I got to tell you this.
Well, that was a staple. That was a staple of life for, you know, way up into, I guess, up into my 20s or so.
Your 20s?
Or maybe my 30s. I mean, it came on the, it started on the air when I was 6, and I don't know when it quit.
I don't either. I know I still search that crap out every chance I can get. The very first episode had Buck Owens and his Buckaroos playing. And I can't remember what tune, but it was Don Rich was playing just this crazy purple freaking Telecaster, which, you know, was not his mainstay, whatever, you know, or, you know, not.
Well,
not,
you know, it's interesting the way things connect, Lee, because you mentioned Roy Clark. The news went out yesterday that that Jimmy Dean, Sausage King and so-called country legend, had gone off to his long home. And one of the trivia pieces noted in there was that he was a meticulous son of a bitch about the people in his band, and he fired Roy Clark.
No.
Not for flatting notes or anything, but because he was late showing up. So
say why Roy's got like little interesting histories about himself too.
I got to listen to it because it turns out Jimmy Dean was nobody that we would respect on this program.
Certainly.
Because he was notorious. He was just a vicious, hateful right winger.
Oh, he was a right wing. Okay.
Yeah, he believed he was still mad even as he died that Social Security existed.
Oh.
Going way, way back, advocating that Social Security be disappeared from the American experience, and his sausage empire was predatory in the extreme. So that got me thinking about Big John. You'll notice Big John dies in the mine, right? Big Bad John.
I have no reverbo bell. I have no sound of a freaking pick hitting the rock. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, it appears in that song.
Yeah, the Big Bad John dies in the mine. Big Bad John is not a member of the union, and Big Bad John is working in a death pit. And you know, the funny thing is that song came out, and it was picked up and adored by all kinds of union miners.
No way.
Oh, God. Well, I mean, it's a staple. It's a staple here in the, it was a staple here in the coal fields, you know, in the 70s and 60s, alongside of 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Which, I do love that song. Which, by the way, we must, can we talk coal for a minute?
We sure can.
Okay. I finally saw Mate One.
Did you really?
I sat there and bawled my eyes out once the, I guess she was Irish, but her son was the one that had his throat cut when she's giving the rabbit to the Italian woman.
Oh, yeah.
That she couldn't stand because they were making polenta or whatever it was.
Yeah, polenta.
You know,
that ain't polenta, that's grits. Yeah.
I sat there, and I just sat there and just effing wept openly. I was just like, you know, I can figure this out. You know, they can figure this out. You know, and I need to ask you that based on that, Chris Carter's character, the one that died, the union organizer, Joe,
yeah,
the one
yeah.
we got nothing but...
Careful there with the spoilers, Lee. There may be people who haven't seen it.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Real character?
No, he's a composite based on real people.
Because he's not in the book that I'm reading about the Battle of Blair Mountain. And like I said, the Battle of Blair Mountain picks up.
The Battle of Blair Mountain happens after Mate One. That's right.
And it
happens after the execution of Two Gun Sid.
So that brother, oh, Jesus. Yeah, and you know, it's, by the way, and I love freaking, it's early in the movie, so maybe it's not a spoiler, but when you're only 7 minutes in, you see freaking, James Earl Jones go, "You watch your mouth, peck of wood."
Yeah.
You know, I've been called a word, you know.
But I ain't never been called,
you know,
no scab.
Yeah, you can't help it how white people are.
Yeah, I can't
what?
Help it how white peoples are, but
yeah.
I ain't never been called no scab.
Yeah, what a fantastic, I am so blown away by that. I mean, you'll have to let me know how realistic that thing is as far as...
Well, it was shot 10 miles from here. Down in all the exterior shots of Mate One, from the gunfight to everything else, were shot down at a little ghost town on the New River called Thurmond, which has its own mine war history. It was a...
Yeah, Thurmond different from Tug? By the way, I got a book in called Blood in Appalachia.
Yeah.
Do you know that one?
Uh-uh.
And it's supposedly about the four mine wars or something like that.
Well, there was a decade or so before the Mingo coal fields, the southern coal fields blew up. There was a mine war here in Fayette County that centered at Thurmond. Thurmond was exclusively a company town. It's a fascinating story. Thurmond was created as a creature, as a capitalism creature. No roads were allowed to go into Thurmond, so that the exclusive access to Thurmond would only be had via the CNO Railroad.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, did you have railroad mining wars going on at the same time?
Oh, yeah. For instance, legend has it that in Thurmond, you did not walk down the tracks at night with a lamp because you would be killed for whatever was in your pocket. More coal moved through Thurmond, West Virginia, than through Richmond, Wheeling, and Pittsburgh combined at one point.
Really?
Yeah. There was a hotel there at which was hosted a poker game that lasted 29 continuous years with people just shuffling in and out of the chairs.
Okay.
Yeah, the Dunglen Hotel, and then across the river was the... Lafayette which was not lovingly renamed the Lay Flat. This county and this state has an old west, wild west sort of history about it.
Well, like I said, that's the way Maywan ends in that movie. You know, that book I'm reading about Blair Mountain picks up, and I'm like, really? This thing starts out essentially with a gunfight at the OK Corral. You know.
But we don't. But let's not teach that in our history books.
Oh no. No. Let's not teach Union at all. I told you, and I had the wrong place. But I sent you an email with a link to, you know, that freaking John L. Lewis monument going into freaking Pennsylvania. You know, with the, I think it was, maybe they died in 62, or maybe it was 62 that died. I can't remember, but it's right there on the border. And the freaking rest area is built on the top of that, you know, mining disaster. You know, I'm not going to hear none of that.
No.
Not to mention.
And the thing is, it's not just negligence, Lee. It is an active suppression of that history.
Agreed. I agree.
And see, that's the thing that's so frustrating with a lot of these guys working on mountaintop removal jobs for Massey.
Mm-hmm.
Their great granddaddies marched on Blair Mountain. Their great granddaddies were willing to lay down their lives to organize.
Wait a minute. You mean the ones that are actually driving the friggin' machines?
Sure. This is a very insular community. I mean, it's not like Massey brought people in to do that. The names here don't change.
That's stunning. That is so stunning. That just, you know, because, well, and I watched another movie, by the way, and here's a fantastic one. Yes, there's a mining undercurrent to the theme. Have you seen a fantastic movie called Songcatcher?
No.
Oh, it's some woman who, and it's like, you know, 1919, and she's in the big city. She gets passed over for professorship. She's a musicologist. She freaking goes out to see her sister that's got a school somewhere in West Virginia and suddenly recognizes that the fact that the hills and the hollers, they've been, you know, isolated so long, them songs are the same as they were when they came over from England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, you know, 200 years before. So all of a sudden you got her lugging a goddamn mule and a freaking recording machine, and Iris Dement's in the movie and everything else.
Oh, wow, okay, I got to see it. If Iris is in it, I got to see it.
Yeah, Songcatcher. Worth your time, sir.
And by the way, you know, Maywan was done by John Sayles. And John Sayles is an amazing, amazing filmmaker. And he went on to make one in the early days of the Bush administration. And lo and behold, there's a mining element in it as well, and it's also worth the watch. He works because he works with tiny little budgets. People come to work with him, and they have to get waivers from the union in order to work with him because he can't pay scale. But he does such amazing quality work that it's okay. And he went on to make a movie in the early part of this century called, I believe, Silver City.
Silver City?
Yeah. Among other people, Danny Houston, you know, John Houston's son.
Right.
Danny Houston's in it. Daryl Hannah is in it. And some others whose names I can't recall.
And John was what, Angelica's grandfather?
No, father.
Father, okay. Hey, by the way, I made that crack about to totally take us off track now, but I made that crack about the pioneers, and every once in a while somebody busts out a fiddle to make things worse.
Yeah, that just ruined me.
Last time I talked to you, but you know, and I went back and looked that thing up. You know, the bagpipes were outlawed. You know, part of the whole Highlands Clearing Act.
Right.
Well, that's what led to, out of fiddle tunes, that friggin' drone string.
I'll be darned.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I had no idea.
Yeah.
But I just know that when you threw that quip out there, I was destroyed. And then I got David in Tennessee following up by mentioning, you know what you call a banjo mute? No, a hammer.
Well, I told you that a while ago, the difference between a banjo and an onion. Nobody cried while cutting up a banjo, but,
yes.
You know. But, no, seriously. So out of that came that whole freaking, you know, that early fiddle tunes. you know. And it's just, it was the passing of, you know, how to get around. Because the bagpipes were a war instrument. Which, if you've ever gone.
Yeah, it's sonic warfare, sure. It's absolutely.
But because you've got that same kind of blood that I do, if you ever go to the YouTube and just punch in tattoo in Edinburgh.
Oh, it'll make the little hair stand up on the back of your neck.
Yeah.
Well, I've told you that you and I are probably distant kin from, you know, about 90 generations back. Because your last name is the same last name as my great-great-grandmother and grandfather.
Right.
Old man John in Virginia, and their portraits hang on our wall.
Well, and I also have freaking pro-slavery Baptist preachers in my goddamn family. You know, it drives me batshit crazy over it.
All you can do is work it off, Lee. I'm convinced of it. All you can do is work it off.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and another great John Sayles movie, Brother from Another Planet.
Oh, writing it down.
Yeah, you can go through and just do the John Sayles filmography, and you'll have a great weekend.
But that's not a blaxploitation?
No, Brother from Another Planet is about an alien who is a black guy who lands on Earth.
Sweet. Well, look, let me get out of here.
And being a Texan, there's another great film that's got a mystery element to it called Lone Star that'll just blow your doors off.
Oh, that's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, that's John Sayles, too.
Chris Cooper's in that, too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Cooper.
Matthew McConaughey.
Right.
Yeah, that's a fantastic movie. Yeah, I saw that one a while ago. I mean, we still actually have, like, little indie theaters here in town.
Well, you know, one of the things that I didn't realize, if you're watching Matewan, you remember the guy, I can't remember his name, but he's the guy who gets shot in the woods and nursed back to health by the hillbillies?
Oh, yeah, Cephas.
Cephas. Well,
yeah, I knew your uncle. You're related to Nimrod, right? He was an idiot, too.
There you go, yeah. Did you happen to notice who Cephas is?
No.
He's the guy who plays the crabby old doctor on Scrubs. He finally got a long-term gig.
Wow. I don't watch much of Scrubs, but I do recognize him now when you said that. The guy that jumped out at me was the CE, whatever his face was, that owned the friggin' restaurant that I already knew was a turncoat because I've been reading about this shit. You know, and I'm like, oh, yeah, you're the prick, by the way. You're the prison warden from Shawshank Redemption. I didn't like you in that movie either.
Right, and, you know, you were asking earlier, is the Chris Cooper character real? That character, and I can't remember his name now, the guy who informs on the union, the guy who's the spy. C.E. Lively. That's a real name.
Right, no, he's in the book. He had a restaurant, and they were talking about the fact that they were holding meetings in his restaurant.
And he escaped and went down, and his progeny still lives down in Atlanta, and holds him up as a hero because C.E. Lively did what he did because he was a virulent anti-communist and was convinced that all them union people were Bolsheviks.
Yeah, I love that. You were red. But, you know, he's the one that actually, if I remember right, and I mean, not just from the movie, but from the book also, he's the guy that walked up and shot Two Gun Sid point blank.
Might have been.
On the courthouse steps, wherever it was at,
that was one of the Baldwin boys, or the Feltz brothers, wasn't it?
Let me see, you lost two Felt boys at the actual shootout.
Right.
But later on, when Sid gets gunned down, whenever he gets called in for a trial, I mean, you know, and I could be totally wrong because this is your neck of the woods and I don't mean to be presuming nothing, you know. But from what I understand, no, he's the one that actually gunned him down. But, yeah, he's the one that, like, stunned it. By the way, speaking of that Matewan thing, or reading the book, when you actually have those people go to trial and the judge recuses himself and he suddenly announces he's retiring and he's suddenly on the side of the prosecution a month later.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
Well, Lee, you've got some watching ahead of you.
Yeah, I should let you go because I've just rambled on long enough. But, dude, we're effed in so many ways that I would have never thought, you know. And, oh, by the way, to your caller, that did the one before me, the one from Baltimore, that totally knocked my ass out when he was talking about watching Germany. He was going, did I watch Argentina? And they look good, too. And I'm like, yeah, because they're all friggin' Germans.
Oh, that was, yeah.
Good night, sir.
Later, Lee.
We'll see you.
Bye now. Calling from the free state of Austin, Texas, that's our buddy Lee. And onward we go, I think. Or not. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Fancy, what's up?
Hey there. Boy, you've had good callers today, and I really enjoyed Gary. He was just wonderful, and a wonderful interview, really.
Thank you.
Interview. I have been dwelling. I've not been on the scariest horror movie I ever saw.
Yes.
And it's come up. It's drifted in. I saw it when I was a kid. And it's one. It was a horror movie that didn't have any monsters from any deep lagoons. It had no aliens. It had no ooh-hoo-hoo music. It was gentle. It was a love story. I think Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner, 1959, black and white, set in Australia. Anybody
on the beach?
You got it. The most frightening movie I have ever seen.
Oh, it's chilling.
Because it's so gentle and so possible. And for the people who've never heard of it, and there was a remake in 2000, I think. I'm not sure.
Didn't live up to it.
I think DiCaprio was a producer on that one. But the concept is, for you folks who came along later in life, is that there's a military, there's a naval ship, and it's in Australia, and it can't go home because there is no home. The entire Northern Hemisphere is dead, and it's dead because of some foolish stuff with radioactivity. And that's it. It's over. Game called. Boom. And what's happening in Australia is they're waiting for the cloud to come to them. And they literally know there's not going to be a next generation.
You know, it's a profoundly creepy film. It really, really is. But you know how I am about making connections. Have you seen that commercial, the Bud Light commercial on TV? Where all the stranded people on the airliner are on the beach. You know, the airliner's crashed and the survivors are all on the beach. And the woman says, I found the radio. We can make contact and get rescued. And the other guy says, I've found the beverage cart. There's plenty of beer.
Okay.
I've been convinced it. You know, a lot of people looked at that and said, well, you know, this is a take on Lost. But by the same token, I look at it and it's a take on the Beach.
I have ever since, well, what is it, 50-some days since the hole came through, the hole got...
Yeah, this is what, day 54?
I have been haunted by that film. And what I'm seeing is the possibility is, one, they'll never plug the hole. You know, it's just going to go till it runs out. And it's going to deoxygenate. It's going to take away the oxygen from the Gulf. And possibly the Atlantic Ocean. And with time, it will very gently and very, with no big bangs and no stingers, ta-da, and no da-da-da-da music, kill us all.
Oh, and by the way, Fancy, I'm the king of multimedia social networking talk radio. Yeah, right. King without country or crown.
How about that?
But I'm good on you. I was just checking my tweets as we talked, and I looked over here, and here's apparently another sort of indirect vote for us not breaking away for President Obama. A tweet from Keith Olbermann: I gather this may not be the big picture, broad canvas, never again speech redefining our nation's energy addiction that many are expecting. I don't know why anybody would expect that, Fancy.
Yeah, you know what? I'm still very torn about the whole thing. I know that if Obama walks in and says, all right, I am now the person in charge. I'm taking over. We're going to do something that he will be eternally criticized for the hubris. Big government came in and failed. They failed on us. See what happens when big government takes over? It's kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation for them. Although I heard something today that was reassuring, and I can't even remember where I heard it. But there's one community, and I'm in the coast, who said to hell with it. We're not waiting for permission. We're going to save ourselves. And they've organized their entire community to protect their beaches, et cetera, et cetera. And they said, you can sign up here, and we'll figure out what to do with you. And one of the groups that's working with it is an all-woman kayak club. And this club is out there. They've taken one island. It's their island. And they're keeping the booms up, and they're keeping the oil back, and they're protecting. And I just wanted to stand up and cheer. If somebody's got a line on that, what a good thing. Now, VP is saying everybody who's in kind of this kind of work has to register with them. And this community has said, excuse me. Now, we're not going to wait for our assignments. We're going to take care of ourselves. And I truly love the idea of an all-woman kayak club taking an island and saving one little.
Oh, you have to love that. If Kate was listening live, she would be calling in, applauding and carrying on an all-woman kayak club. That's beautiful.
Is that good or what? I mean, the other thing, the other laugh out loud today.
We have oars and we're not afraid to use them.
The other thing that I've spent several days not smiling. I've really been in the grumpies and not happy about much. And I'm, you know, got the radio running, or the computer radio, and I heard about the big Jesus that got, that got.
Yeah, Lottie sent that along to me earlier today, and I immediately drew the line between that.
Yeah, And
lightning striking the boat. How can you not?
But I want to point out something here, and I think I'm quote, God, I try to attribute everything that's not an original thought with me, which is most of everything, and I'm not real sure, but I think it's Eric Hoffer. And you remember Eric Hoffer and the True Believer?
Yes.
Okay. He said a lot of crap, but he also said a lot of really interesting things. And if it's Hoffer or whomever said that when one believes in a philosophy or a religion, we'll keep that as a loose thing for right now, and it fails, the first reaction is generally, it didn't fail, it was that we didn't do it right. So you've got the primitive who says, hey, wait a minute, we danced the dance, and we chanted the chant, and we all got out there and wiggled our butts to the north, and it didn't rain.
And it's not that God doesn't exist.
It's that we did it wrong.
We wiggled our butts to the left first instead of to the right.
We wiggled our butts first and then chanted the chant, and it would have worked. And I'm hearing that a lot with the Ayn Rand folks.
That was the entire theme of the end of the Bush administration. You know, don't y'all be getting down on conservatism. Conservatism still works,
right?
But George Bush wasn't a conservative, and he didn't conservatize. No, trust us, we'll save America yet.
You know, I read Ayn Rand in college, which was about a billion years ago. And 2 or 3 years ago, I thought, okay, damn it, I need to, at least read Atlas Shrugged again. And I can't do that. I can't put myself through that. So I went to the library and I got the talking books, right? Which is about 10 tapes. And I may have gotten through 5 of them. Now that I'm past really good and groovy on romance, there's nothing there. Holy shit, that's just a really...
It's awful. And here, you want the fun little postscript on that, Fancy? I got a little posting to my Facebook page the other day. I can't remember who sent it along. Said, "Oh, Bob, you're just going to love that. Love this. Principal location shooting has begun on Atlas Shrugged."
Oh, boy. Well, you know what? It will.
And guess who is playing, oh, what was her, the
Dagny Taggart.
Yeah, Dabney Coleman is what I was about to say, but no.
Close.
Dagny Taggart. Guess who's playing her, apparently?
I'm lost.
Angelina Jolie.
Oh, shit. Sorry about that.
No, my first thoughts exactly. You know, as soon as I remembered that it was Dagny Taggart instead of Dabney Coleman.
Oh, golly, golly.
Of course, I'd kind of like to see Dabney Coleman as Dagny Taggart, but yeah, that's because I'm sick and twisted and shallow.
Well, he's got the shoulders for it. What a say. Yeah, it's... I just want to repeat that point one more time for those of you who, because I will test later, that one of Hoffer's main theses was that the true believer personality existed before the philosophy it espoused. So that the true believer Christian and the true believer communist and the true believer whatever, the personality was there before they found the thought to which they espoused, and that one they could have actually been, you know, they're interchangeable at some level, but that the belief is when it fails is not that the theory failed, it's that it just wasn't done right, and that to me is that's where I get, oh wait a minute, I want to talk logic to these people who oh please. So wrong, so wrong, so wrong on so many points.
By the way, you've been awarded a toaster for Dabney Coleman has the shoulders for it. and you know, no,
and you get a toaster for on the beach. I didn't expect you to have that. That goes back so far.
But to go back to what you mentioned about the Hoffer's principle or Hoffer's theory. You know, I go over to TED every now and then when I feel like I need my brain expanded.
Oh, yeah. If you folks don't know about TED Talks, just Google in TED Talks and then at random choose something. It will renew the fact that intelligence does exist in the universe somewhere.
And I caught one earlier this week from David Byrne that just blew me away, you know, the talking heads. Who says that the space, who posits the theory that the space in which music is originally created or for which music is originally created dictates the nature of the music, which it kind of makes sense now that I say it out loud, but I wouldn't have ever thought of that.
Whoa. The space.
The space in which music is created dictates the terms of the creation of the music.
I'm not clear on the word space.
The venue.
Oh, okay.
And then today I got a little notification of a TED talk that is, lo and behold, and it's part of that whole, you know, read the book nature of this program, from a guy named Michael Shermer, who I wouldn't know from Adam's house cat. But Michael, and this is just a blurb from the email I got, because it was kind of, I went and watched it. It was quite fascinating. Michael Shermer says, "Our human tendency to believe in strange things, from UFOs to lucky jerseys, comes from two basic hardwired survival skills." So I would guess that he would not disagree if you said that the willingness to believe in the hokum precedes the hokum itself.
I took a confirmation class, Reform Judaism, Dallas, Texas, late 50s. And the rabbi who's teaching the class said that all religion comes from animism, totemism, fetishism, and taboo. He said 50 years from now you'll be able to remember that and recite it, and damn I can, you know that. But one of the things that came out of that, of the animism and totemism and fetishism, is that you know, the cave guy's having a fair day, and he finds an interesting rock, and he picks it up, and then later Lunch walks by in the form of a really big and sort of slow deer, and it's a good hunting day. And that rock, from then on, has the power, you know, to bring in Lunch.
Rosebud.
Yeah.
How did this turn into movie night on the Horn?
I don't know, but I'm retired, so I'm giving myself the gift of either every movie I never saw. I just saw Kentucky Fried Movie.
Oh, the mother of all silly American movies. That, you know,
well, it came out in 77. I was Disney.
Right, and there's no airplane. There's no naked gun. There is no police academy. None of that happens without the Kentucky Fried Movie.
Well, so and in honor of Dennis Hopper, I watched Easy Rider, and I was really impressed with the Jack Nicholson bit in there. I don't think I'd ever seen it. And I also saw Buckaroo Banzai, and I took myself to Rocky Horror, of course. And I've been doing a kind of a retrospective thing, but I can't find a playable copy of On the Beach, so I was going for that, and I'm decided that Providence is just saving me from being.
Well, I don't, you know, I do not know, nor will I inquire as to your financial status, but the best bargain in movie watching today is without a doubt, and they haven't paid me to say this, Netflix.
That's probably so. Yeah.
For nine bucks.
I live very close to the edge on.
Yeah, but for $9 a month, you can watch all the movies you can rent.
Yeah, but that's.
And a lot of them you can watch online.
Yeah.
Just click the button.
I have been enjoying what I've been doing, though. There's some. Oh, speaking of Jolie, I saw Angelina Jolie. I really saw her do a nice job. I hadn't seen the film before. Girl Interrupted.
Yes.
She's second banana in that one. And it's set in a mental hospital. She really is quite good. She must be very young.
Well, that, you know, that turn got her an Oscar.
Well, she was quite good. Quite good.
And that was a dark and difficult movie to watch.
Yeah, but Ray of Hope at the end. It does, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't go plummeting down.
And that, of course, was based on events in a very, very famous mental hospital.
Well, and the author, it was pretty much biographical of the author.
Yes, it was autobiographical, without a doubt. Yep.
No, okay, well, hey, I'm going to go away. And sorry I brought a downer on us. I just... And oh, you'll find the quote for me. What is this? The world will end with a whimper and not a bang?
Yeah. I recognize, yes, that quote.
I'm just hoping that it's not an oil-covered...
Kaboom?
Whimper.
Could be. And I guess there are other people out there who are actually watching the Obama address... because I just got a note in from Andy in Jersey. Oh, I suspect I just lost Fancy, but I just got a note in from Andy in Jersey who said, we're not all responsible. You get CEO Tony Hayward down there with his chairman of the board, Carl Henrik Svanberg, or what remains of the platform or ship sucking up the oil above the gusher, and aim the big guns of a battleship on them. Tell them to shut it down now, fire, fire. Skip the Obama speech. It'll be go down to the Gulf and enjoy the beach, spend some money. Is it time to impeach Obama? Is it time to impeach Obama yet? Open question. It is 11 minutes past the hour of 8 o'clock. I guess the address has begun. I have no idea whatsoever of what's going on in that address, and then like Sandra said a little bit ago, let's let's don't and say we didn't, or let's don't and say we did. Let's don't watch the Obama address and just tell everybody that we did, because we know what's going in it already. Speaking of movies, though, I am reminded of something. You know, I assume, that a little something significant happened today. General David Petraeus was supposed to testify to Congress about the ongoing disaster that is Afghanistan. Of course, he'd tell you that it was going swimmingly. And, you know, sometimes the human body has a way of overriding our ability to simply sit and lie. And General David Petraeus today literally passed out, you know, the whole thump, head on table thing while testifying before Congress. He was gotten up and walked away. He came back about 20 minutes later. I just happened to have audio of what he was saying at the time he passed out.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Yeah, see, that's what it's about. That was what happened to General Petraeus. He said he was feeling a little. He came back to the room, and thanks to horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner for passing this along, the follow-up. He said he was feeling a little bit lightheaded there. And then he looked at the panel and said that I have to tell you, General Ripper, out at Burpleson, was correct. I was sapped and impurified of all my precious bodily fluids. God, it is movie night on the horn tonight, isn't it? Jesus. So we'll take a little break and come back with more of your phone calls. On the way, this being Tuesday and everything, on the way is Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, the Green News Report coming up. For your delectation, I guess, delectation. And then we will come back for more of your phone calls. It's Tuesday on the horn. This is listener-supported liberal radio. Emphasis on listener-supported. Thanks to those of you who do. And if you haven't lately, it would be a great time to go to the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com and pitch into the kitty. Because it's the only thing that stands between getting this done and not. And at some point, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the stuff that faces us here. But right now, let's take a break and come back to your phone calls. And before that, of course, check out Brad and Freezy. Brad and Desi, where did I get Freezy? I think I'm the one who needs the break. Check out Brad and Desi in the Green News Report. We'll be back. I'm Bob.
Fire! Radio action! Michael Franti, Letticy and LZ in the place. Gone International with Sly and Robbie on the track. It's unpatriotic, but I call it when I see it. When I see it's idiotic, the tears of one mother are the same as any other. Drop food on your kids while you're murdering the fathers. But don't bother to show it on CNN. Brothers and sisters, don't believe them that it's a war against evil. It's really just revenge engaged on the poor. It's by the same rich men. Fight terrorists wherever they be found. But why you not bombing Tim McVeigh's hometown? You can speak what you want. Propaganda television. You can all bomb it. It's terrorism. Chase it down. All I am.
one even really knows why. They sold lies in the vision of fear. We yelled and cried, no one listened for years. We're like, who put us here? And who's responsible? Well, there's no debating, cause if they ask me, I think it's big corporations. World Trade Organization, trilateral action, international sanctions. Satan seems like it'll be an endless price tag of war, tremendous and most disturbingly, the death toll is so horrendous. So I send this to those that feel the defenders. Send us into harm's way, we should all make a remembrance that this is bigger than terrorism. Blood is blood is blood in them. Love is true vision. Who will listen? How many songs it takes for you to see? You can bomb the world in pieces, you can't bomb it in me.
Want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
This is a public service announcement. With Gibbs Horn!
There's a new type of music program coming to the Horn.
They wanted me about a summer or whatever. Picture me buying the scam. I said never.
But I won't heed the battle call.
Music for liberals. Music for activists. Music with a social conscience.
Take me down K Street.
The People's Mixtape.
Johnny's dead and Mitch is gone and Kelly have the lyrics out on the list. And that goes on and on. Goes
coming soon to the Head On Radio Network.
Cut your flag, the gal won't get you into heaven anymore.
Wake up! Wake up!
It's Tuesday, June 15th, 2010.
For years, the oil industry swore this could never happen.
The nightmare well. Extreme storms lash the Ozarks. Plus, oil industry in the hot seat.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Seafood from the Gulf of Mexico is safe to eat. Now, I had some of that seafood for lunch, and it was delicious.
We'll leave the snarky comment to Stephen Colbert today.
The latest news from Louisiana. From now on, every order of shrimp comes pre-blackened.
That does sound delicious. This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report, sponsored in part by Velvet Revolution's new campaign, ProtectOurElections.org. Fighting for real election reform in Congress once and for all. Please join the fight against corporate influence, voter suppression, and unverifiable, privatized voting systems. Sign the petition to demand election reform from Congress now at ProtectOurElections.org. That's ProtectOurElections.org. Okay, Desi Doyen, it is day 50, Adam. Who knows at this point how long we've been gushing oil into the Gulf?
It's day 57.
Day 57. Okay, what do you have for us?
Well, extreme storms have lashed Arkansas and Oklahoma. Torrential rainstorms in Arkansas caused flash flooding that killed 20 campers in a campground in the middle of the night over the weekend. Flash floods also swept through Oklahoma City on Monday. The deluge dumped nearly a foot of rain in 6 hours. Hundreds were rescued from their submerged cars. It's been a record winter and a record spring for storms. Record flooding just a few weeks ago in Nashville, also in Rhode Island and South Dakota. Now, while climate scientists repeat that no one weather event can be blamed on global warming, they do predict a trend toward more extreme weather events.
Yeah, it's odd. We don't hear the climate deniers out there pointing to all of these storms as a proof that there's not climate change, do we?
Well, that wouldn't fit, would it?
No, it wouldn't fit with the narrative.
And like we said, it's day 57 of the BP oil disaster in the Gulf. President Obama made his fourth trip to the Gulf Coast on Monday and Tuesday, traveling the coast from Louisiana to Mississippi to Alabama to Pensacola, Florida. On the trip, the president encouraged Americans to visit the Gulf and the many beaches that aren't affected by the spill. He also announced a new initiative to ensure that seafood coming out of the Gulf is safe.
Seafood from the Gulf today is safe to eat. But we need to make sure that it stays that way.
Yeah, it's safe today, maybe, from some of it, but okay.
The president will speak to the nation on the BP oil disaster on Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, his first ever Oval Office speech. Now, will he go small and talk only about the direct response to the BP oil disaster, or will he go big and call for the nation to transition to clean energy?
Will he call for Congress and the Senate to transition to clean energy? They're the ones who need to pass a clean energy bill now. He needs to put pressure on his own Democrats.
In an interview with Roger Simon of Politico.com, Obama said the BP oil disaster, quote, rivals 9/11 in its ability to change the course of American history.
Frankly, I hope that it does. This is the 9/11 for the clean energy movement world. It needs to be. We need to take a direct turn at this point, the way we took a direct turn to supposedly fight terrorism all of a sudden. Now is the moment to be seized to change our energy future. The only question is, will Obama make that happen?
Senate Democrats are pressuring BP to set up an escrow account of $20 billion, diverting a planned dividend payment to shareholders, setting aside that money instead to pay claims for individuals and businesses. But today, in a hearing on Capitol Hill, BP America CEO Lamar McKay declined to commit to setting up any kind of outside account at this time. Congressional investigators released a preliminary report detailing five major fatal decisions made by BP managers on the Deepwater Horizon rig in its last days, alleging that BP ignored warnings in favor of cutting costs. One BP engineer reportedly called the rig the nightmare well. Read it yourself at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
The other companies here today will contend that this was an isolated incident.
BP wasn't the only company in the hot seat today. The CEOs of all of the major oil companies were summoned to the House Committee on Energy and Environment to testify on their oil spill response plans, or the lack thereof. Democrats criticized the oil companies for all having nearly identical oil spill response plans for the Gulf, which are, of course, clearly inadequate. Congressman Bart Stupak, Democrat of Michigan, criticized Exxon for its limited oil spill response plan.
While ExxonMobil has 40 pages on its media response strategy, its plan for resource protection is only 5 pages long, and its plan for oil removal is just 9 pages long.
I think what the hearings tell us is that these problems are endemic across the industry. It's not just BP. They're the unlucky bastards who had an oil well blow up on them. But all of these oil companies are similarly unprepared for a disaster like this, and they've been allowed to get away with it. Read about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. And today we're welcoming aboard our newest affiliate, the Nicole Sandler Show. You can check her out at radioornot.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And we'll let the President of the United States sing us out today. This has been your Green News Report.
I talked to the experts, so I know who's asked to care, kicks and butt. So I know who's asked to care, so I know who's asked to care, kicks and butt.
Twenty-nine minutes past the third hour of the program this evening, and I'm going back to the phones post haste. But I would ask your indulgence for a moment. First of all, to share an email with you. Coming from our buddy Ron in Raleigh, a little shout out to Fancy. Damn you, Bonsai! Okay, there's that. And coming in from Reverbo. Author of the Cavalcade of Crazy blog at headonradionetwork.com. On the other hand, with regard to whether or not to watch the president, which we the voting was very clearly in favor of not doing, on the other hand, says Reverbo, this is what we're risking if we all stay with Horn Talk instead of checking in with the Big O. What if this time he goes completely bionic and drills BP, the oil whores, and the entire energy complex through the greedy, their greedy skulls with one of their own dull bits? And it could get even better. What if it turns out one of us missed being caller number 19 who gets a ride with the president and gets to ride with the president and drop Tony Hayward into the commemorative BP tar pit and energy theme park from the Obamacopter? If not now, when? Just saying, says Reverbo. And now, something I mentioned a little bit ago, and I'm just going to share this with you. I'm not proud of it. I am deeply ashamed, but then again, I didn't make this situation. From time to time, we have talked about the fact that you may turn on, you may go to Head on Radio Network some evening and click Listen Live, and there won't be a program here. That risk is getting significant. And this is not Bob's standard Oral Roberts, God's going to call me home pitch. This is not that. This is more by way of explaining a grim situation here that you simply need to understand, because if nothing else, this program rests on a firm bedrock of candor. I have mentioned on a couple of occasions the failed septic system here. I am embarrassed as all hell about that, because I am an environmentalist. By way of explanation, I have mentioned to you in passing that where we live and where the studios of the Horn are is a roughly 80-year-old house, with something I found out in the past few months is an 80-year-old septic system that has gone quickly and straight to hell, complete with a failed leach field. Those of you who know the specifics of septic systems will know the particulars of what I'm talking about. At any rate, it has failed. And someone around here complained. And that brought the full wrath of the County Health Department down on us. I told you a long time ago that in founding the Horn, I told you the story of the founding of the Horn, how Wayne, as a permanent memorial to his beloved and departed wife, Gina. Hence, Gina, it's all for you at the end of every program. Wayne funded the building of, or the outfitting of the studio. Then, for a couple of years, we went without asking for a dime. We did it all on our own. And in doing it all on our own, a significant portion of that involved Agnes and I tapping out the last of what we had set aside. Even portions of my patrimony from the passing of my father went into keeping the horn on the air. And you have generously contributed to keep our monthly bills paid. Here's where we stand. I have 30 days. And like I said, this is more by way of explaining to you that we may be off the air in a month. And there won't be a damn thing for me to do about it. We may not be on the air because we may be shut down here. And we may be shut down here because, simply put, we may not be able to function. Hell, we may be run out of our home because of that failed septic system. The replacement cost for it is upwards of $5,000 if it's a dime. And I am busting my hump trying to figure out a way to get my little hands on funds sufficient to do that. And I've got 30 days to pull it off. Well, that's where we stand. The whole new shooting match has to be installed. And frankly, every penny we've got goes to running this. Some from your contributions, some from the participation of Cold River Mountain Watch, and a big chunk of it out of our pockets. You know, something like a simple car repair is crippling around here. When I say that working our betters don't understand working America, that they don't understand that we are constantly faced with miserable Hobson's choices between do I buy the life-saving medication or do I replace the bald tires on the truck that may kill me before the disease can on some slick and icy road, or that a guy working for a living can be reduced to penury by a transmission falling out. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not making crap up. Because, by God, I'm living it. And my family's living it. We don't talk about being working people. We don't talk about being working class as if working class were some sort of esoteric academic exercise. We talk about it because that is our reality. We are in a hole that we didn't dig, with a mess that we did not create, And no, I can't go somewhere else and broadcast as I'm being asked in the chat room. No, this is it. This is all there is. It's this or under the bridge. So if I'm a little scatterbrained in the next 30 days, it's because I'm scrambling, trying to figure out desperately some way to raise $5,000 to dig a hole in the ground and get happy with the County Board of Health. The County Board of Health, by the way, that at the same time they're enforcing certain laws with regard to me, laws with which I take no issue as an environmentalist, they're enforcing certain laws with regard to me while they turn a blind eye to deadly poisons. And the reason I'm talking about this is because the conversation that we started this evening with Dr. Steingraber with regard to living downstream, at the same time, I'm a problem that can amount to literally Bob's not on the air tonight because he is in jail. At the same time that may happen, none of my betters who have ruined an entire mountainscape above my home and have killed streams and poisoned people downstream from it, they're sitting down to dinner with nice silverware and nice tablecloths, and they're arriving in nice automobiles. Because that's the world they deserve. Because they get away, literally, with murdering me and my fellow community members. So this isn't necessarily a plea for you guys to come up with $5,000. I tell you every month that we have to come up with $2,000 to keep things going, and that's what we have to come up with to keep things going. And you are responsible, or you take the responsibility for doing that, because this is worth it to you, and I thank you. But I've got a problem to solve that seems insoluble. And there's no Kobayashi Maru. I can't reset it and make it go away. And I can't look at the guy and say, listen, why don't you come back and talk to me after you've dealt with the thugs that set off God knows how many million pounds of high explosives above my town. Do that and then we'll talk. I can't do that because they'll just say, you know, the guy with the cruiser back there and the flashing blue lights, he's got a set of bracelets for you. I'm probably not going to mention this again because it's just a little too hard to mention. I could play the closing music for this program right now and crawl into a corner and roll myself into a fetal ball and suck my thumb for the rest of the night out of the godforsaken shame I have over even mentioning it. But it had to be mentioned sooner or later. It had to be mentioned because I didn't want you to turn on your computer and go to the website and, well, damn, where's Bob? Oh, Bob's in the clink. Bob's racking up fines to the tune of $100 a day that he doesn't have. That starts on July the 7th, the $100 a day and or the clink. You know, look, I know what reality is. I live with reality. I live in the real world. You never hear a pitch like this coming from some right-wing talker. That's because there is a vast network of right-wing funding. They don't hold their hands out to their listeners. Because Cook Industries just signs a check and leaves it blank and says, you fill in the fund numbers. Because the right-wing gets it. And ours doesn't. Left wing, there is no left wing. But what passes for liberals and progressives who aren't you who aren't people who think that this is worthwhile, they don't get it. And if this goes away, well, they'll just hope that some other poor bastard steps up and starts carrying the water. Because, you know, why buy the cow when you're already getting the milk for free? Now, I'm not going to go places that I'm tempted to go and say things that I know better than to say. But I've been knee-deep in number crunching for the last couple of days on issues that don't relate to this. And looking at what a tiny pittance it would take for an organization to step up and just say, hey, you know, keep doing what you're doing, it's great. Do more, Bob. Bring more voices into the fight. Create an apprenticeship program for young talkers so they can do it too, and they'll be ready when Rush Limbaugh finally breathes out and doesn't breathe in again. Do that, Bob. But they're not there. So we don't have that kind of comprehensive funding that the right wing has. And I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place that is so damn tight that I can't tell the difference between the rock and the hard place. So that's enough of this, I suppose. And I apologize if you feel like you've been put upon by me bringing this in. If I've made you uncomfortable, I apologize. But I had to let you know where we stand. Because it would have been extremely unfair of me to sit here and talk every night and then one night simply be gone. And you wondering what happened to Bob. What happened to Agnes? What happened to the kids? Are they still there? Did Don Blankenship finally get them? No, it won't be anything as dramatic as that. It's much more prosaic. We will literally be taken down by a hole in the ground that doesn't work anymore. So that's where we are. With the time remaining in the program, let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Yeah, that's a bit of a nightmare, that little tale you just told.
Welcome to my life as Franz Kafka. I expect to wake up in the morning and I'm going to be a bug.
Well, no, but see, I was like, you know, reeling from the amount you're talking about. And then you're talking about you're going to be fined on top of that if you don't comply.
Right. $100 a day.
Okay. So,
and after a couple of the weeks of that, I think it goes to $500 a day.
Okay. But so what's the, I mean, if you don't have the funds, what are you supposed to tell them? I mean, there's no other, it's either you pay up within 30 days or they start fining you $100.
Yeah, I gotta go say, look, see, I've bought all the stuff and I've got the guy signed up and we're going to install this son of a bitch and you have to apply it and you have to approve the plan. Because see, that's the other fun thing. I can't even go out and do it myself. I have to have their blessing. So, you know, that goes into extra money to pay a guy who is state certified to do this.
Okay, and this isn't a place that levels mountains? I'm sorry, I'm just sort of stunned.
Yeah, see, it takes me to the same place.
I know it's not, because I know how the bureaucracy is. I mean, when the state gets stuck into you, it's hideous. I know that you're talking some real shit here. Listen, I just think that horn folks, you know, $50, you need to cough up. I don't really know what to say, and I don't blame you because you have this microphone, and we know what time it is with these liberals who don't dole out it. You know what I mean? So whatever. You don't need to be feeling anyway about asking. I, you know, like I said, I'll be quite happy to cough up, you know, my little measly 50. And some of these other folks who depend, and I do say depend on Bob and this show. Shit, I don't know. I don't know what other option you have except to appeal to, you know, your fan base. So,
well, I've been to the bank, Sandra. I've been to the bank. I can still hear the laughter.
Well, no, listen, we all, I mean, not all of us, but I mean, most of us know, you know, what the deal is. You know what I mean?
It's broke.
So, yeah, really.
And please understand, I should have said this. It's not like this was the first thing we said. No, I went to granting organizations. And here's the fun part. We're too rich.
Well,
we are broker than the Ten Commandments and poor as Job's turkey. And we're too rich.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's like I already can just imagine what kind of Kafka-esque nightmare you're about to head into. But so you literally have 30 days, and is there like a down payment you can hit them with? I mean, what is?
If I can go to them and say, hey, you know, I've got the wherewithal to build this thing, and I've got the guy, then they'll talk to the guy, and the guy will put the plan together, and they'll get off my ass.
Right, okay. Well, no, I just, you know, because the whole idea of the per-day fine, that'll, you know, not only end your show, but that is really dangerous grounds for you to be on. You need to figure out...
Yeah, because what comes after that is they just flat-out condemn my property.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It sounds like it's some sort of spiral to just a nightmare. I'm so sorry to hear this. Like I said, I don't know. I don't know what people will do, and I, you know, like I said, I'm about to.
Well, I'm looking in the chat room.
Now.
I'm looking in the chat room, and there's people going, Jesus, if we can get 100 people to throw in $50, it's done.
Yeah, right. But that's exactly. And you know, like I said, I don't know if you need to have to set up some sort of separate fund for it or not. But like I said, I'm about to do the PayPal for you now.
Well, this is, you know, like I said, this was a skullcracker to even mention. But the fact
I can imagine. Listen,
but you know, when your beloved spouse walks in holding a letter in her hand, and doesn't say anything, and just holds it out, and the tears are streaming down her face.
Oh no! I know it's deadly serious. Listen, like I said, you know, we all use the tools and the access to whatever that we have. You have this. So you would be a fool not to use it, Bob. I mean, that's, you know, you got to be real about it. What's, you know, so you need to step back from saying that business. That's a bunch of bullshit. You're fine. And like I said, people out there, step up or this is going to be over with. Because I know, you know, that's what's going to happen. And I, for one, would be just sort of very heartbroken. And then I'd be worried at how it's going for you, you know.
Yeah, because, you know, and at the end of the day, that's the thing that scares the piss out of me, Sandra, is this idea of, you know, maybe being separated from my kids or something like that.
That's what I'm saying. I'm about to say you got a family. You know, it's not, I don't know, I just am sort of, I feel kind of ill thinking that it's some sort of bullshit like this that can take you out. It's horrible. Terrible.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, it's scaring the daylights out of me. And I'm not one to shake in my boots and come apart, but really, I mean, my blood pressure's up right now, and if I wasn't just hanging on for dear life to my sanity, I'd be bawling.
Yeah, well, no.
And it wouldn't be them Jimmy Swaggart Oral Roberts tears either.
Well, listen, I can only hope that once again, you know, I mean, this is not really my thing, but listen, you people need to step the hell up. Oh, no. You know, I wish I could give more, but I'm gonna have to drop that 50 tonight. Cause I know it's a drop in a bucket, but if you get more people doing that little drop in a bucket, 20, 25, and up.
Well, you know, what I'll do is I'll go out and I'll start marshaling, you know, as it becomes available, I will go out and start marshaling materials. I'll go buy the damn tank.
Well,
you know, I'll buy the pipe and stuff, and then we'll talk to the guy who does the dozer work.
one of them, whatever you have to do to sort of have, you know, to sort of step them off of you first. You know what I mean? Whatever intent you need to show and all this sort of business. I mean, I think that's what you have to deal with, because I know. I've had problems with the IRS, and once they get stuck into you, Jesus, it's this non-ending, you know?
And look, I mean, I'm not kidding. The idea, because at some point, you know, if you press a human being hard enough, if you push them hard enough, sooner or later they will do something stupid, even somebody as rational as me. And my ass in Dayglo orange with plastic orange shower shoes shuffling around in ankle bracelets, yeah, that's not something I can stand to even contemplate.
Oh, no. I don't even want to. I can't even imagine that. The jail factor is just beyond the beyond. So I hope that you will keep us updated. You know what I mean? I mean, as far as turning it on, you're gone. I mean, if that happens, that's life. I'm more concerned about, you know, the jail thing is what I'm stuck into. I'm like, oh, no.
No, I won't do well there.
Well, yeah, I don't know too many of us who, you know what I mean? It's a horrible outcome that you're talking about, so.
Yeah, and who's, you know, Sandra, who set this system up? Whose bright idea was it that by fining somebody $100 a day for something they can't afford $5,000 to do, is a way to remedy the problem?
Well, no, but that's how working people are sort of laid out. I mean, that's standard. You know, it's the whole thing. You know, you that woman who lost her home for $85 water bill. You see what I'm saying? That's standard with.
Yeah, or the woman we were talking about last night who wound up in the clink for a $300 debt to a lumber yard.
Right, right. And so they get stuck into you with this bullshit, and then you end up, the fines and stuff cost more than the original issue. And then there you are, losing your property with your family. I mean, the whole thing is a nightmare, and I don't want to say and have any thoughts that it's going to go out that way. So I'm really glad you said something about it, and I know you have a listenership, and, you know, I'm just saying it's about time for folks to do what they need to do here. So anyway.
Well, thank you, Sandra. I appreciate it, because you put it in better words than I did.
Well, it's kind of like, it's enough with the dumb shit. This sounds really bad for you, and I just hope that people will come through, especially all you regulars who be calling nonstop like me. Shit. Pony up.
Sandra, thank you. Thank
okay,
you, dear.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. And again, you know, I'm sorry to do this to you, but that's... Listen, this is a microcosm. You know, maybe some other liberal talker doesn't have septic system problems. But we're all sweating the nut every month. I mean, all of us. In my case, you know, we exist by your good graces. And more than anything, I felt the need to be candid with you. If some of you are disgusted, that's okay. I understand. And God knows I would have taken care of this. Well, like I said, I've still got the ring of the laughter at the bank in my ears. Really? You? $5,000? Oh, Jesus, no way. Get out. So that's where we are. I guess I'm going to knock off for the evening. You know what I need to do? I need to go listen to Malloy. I need to listen to Malloy and just let the words flow over me like cold water at a mountain stream, and let some of this icky just wash out of me. That's what I need to do. Thank you. Thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for listening patiently to that story. And thank you for everyone who is stepping up in this effort. That was not my purpose. Have a great evening, everybody. Head on over and let Malloy do for you what he does for me. It's cleansing, you know. Thanks go out to everybody who does make this happen. Always they go out. That's why I make sure to mention it every night. Thanks to John Fox, chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, show host. There's nothing around here that needs doing that can't be done. That he can't do. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. To Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, who has made liberal talk a viable commodity because of what he did beginning in 2002 with the White Rose Society. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to our chat room moderator, Lottie. Thanks to our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne, osborneinc.com. Our op-ed columnist, Reverbo with Cavalcade of Crazy, and my head writer, David in Tennessee. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Evening edition of the Horn. About a minute past the hour, and it is. This should prove to be a very, very special, very, very interesting Tuesday evening. We have a conversation scheduled in a few moments, and it is. It's a conversation that took a lot of work to create, and most of that work was expended by our good friend Preston, who took it upon himself to do the booking for this. And you know what? I can't say enough about that effort, simply because The time needed to book a conversation like this is not insignificant. And so many thanks go out to Preston for this. In a few minutes, we're going to have a conversation with Sandra Steingraber. She is the best-selling author of a book called Living Downstream, now in its second edition. If Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was defining for her generation, so too is this book a defining statement for ours and for our time. I'm not sure if this book exists as a Kindle book on Amazon, and frankly, I don't know if it's an audiobook. Perhaps we'll find out from Dr. Steingraber. It comes from the Capo Press, a member of the Perseus Books Group, and it is readily available, Living Downstream, An Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer and the Environment. I think you will find this to be a fascinating conversation, and I think you will find the book well worth the effort of having on your shelf. Of course, it's the kind of book also that you read, you digest, and then sooner or later you're going to find somebody and say, holy crap, you got to read this book. No, I won't wait for you to buy it. Here, take my copy. Just bring it back. But they won't. And what they'll do is they'll take your copy, they'll read it, and pass it on to somebody else. It's that important. Dr. Steingraber literally establishes a threshold for what we have to do as a species in order to continue our inhabitation of the planet. I've been reading this book for over a week now. I'm pretty close to done with it. And you would think that since it's got to do with environmental poisons and toxins and a particularly loathsome disease or cluster of diseases, you would think, wow, this is going to be a downer. It's not, because that is the magic of Dr. Steingraber. She is not merely a scientist, if there's such a thing as being merely a scientist. She is not just an ecologist. She is not just a biologist, although she holds a PhD. She also holds a master's degree in creative writing. And so this book reads much more like poetry than it does some sort of cataloging of grim fact. Let's take an example. Let's just go to the beginning of the book. The very beginning. I have a buddy of mine, and I have an old theory that says you can tell a lot about a book by its first paragraph. If the first paragraph doesn't grab you, the 432nd one's not going to do you any good either. Well, this has a first paragraph that'll grab you right out of the gate. Now, imagine this is a science book, okay? But it's also a very personal book. On a clear night after the harvest, central Illinois becomes a vast and splendid planetarium. This transformation amazed me as a child. In one of my earliest memories, I wake up in the back seat of the car on just such a night. When I look out the window, the black sky is so inseparable from the plowed black earth. Which dots are stars and which are farmhouse lights? That it seems I am floating in a great, dark, glittering bowl. And consider the epigraph to the book itself. A small fable
There was once a village along a river. The people who lived there were very kind. These residents, according to parable, began noticing increasing numbers of drowning people caught in the river's swift current. And so they went to work devising ever more elaborate technologies to resuscitate them. So preoccupied were these heroic villagers with rescue and treatment that they never thought to look upstream to see who was pushing the victims in. And then, very simply, this book is a walk up that river. We will be having about a 30-minute conversation, and I expect it to be as good a conversation, as important a conversation, as has been lately had on the Horn. It is that significant. It is that important. So with that in mind, we will take a moment, and we will I will get Dr. Steingraber on the line, and we will begin that conversation. So bear with me for a moment while I make the connection and prepare all as it needs to be. And we will come.